There is a group of us who are determined that the decadence of the present day can and will be halted. A new political regime is planned to lend weight to one's arguments amid the rush and whirl of humanity. It is sometimes necessary to be persuasive.
Persuasive?
There are a few vague rituals, it is true. A little occultism, a touch of mysticism at Pelham House, nothing more.
Evil begets evil. There is an unholy aura in this place. And it is not a question of a little occultism or a touch of mysticism, Mr. Denham. It is vampirism, and there's a host of damned souls at Pelham House.
It's Friday. It is 2 minutes past five, and welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on Friday, the 14th of April, 2023, streaming live from the PRSC Arts Centre in Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream and at Radio Q. UK.com in Camberley, Surrey. Also live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app. So many different ways to listen. Available all, free from all good app stores, including the Apple Store, but please not Google. And we put a link up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk to a non-Google app store, which is a much better place to go because Google mess around. Say, for example, with Telegram, you get a different version that Telegram put out if you get it, you're downloading it from the Play Store, the Google Play Store. So, I'm Tony Gosling. Thanks for turning off the psycho in the corner. I hope you had a good, decent Easter and saw some of your family, etc. Gaslighting us, that little psycho is, with its military-grade psyops, smearing 30 pence a pill ivermectin, COVID treatment, which could have saved 60,000 British lives. Easy to say that in hindsight, I suppose. But also Matt Hancock's crimes against humanity. Time to weaponise a new variant, is it, Matt? Maybe, because there's a new variant out this week, isn't there? But anyway, Matt's out the picture, thank God, at last. An unhappy bunch of Goldman Sachs Bilderberg Nazi death trip deep state losers, including in Ukraine, dark enlightenment and zombies waging war on the British people now, as well as Putin. So this is what the BBC might sound like if it were free from the tentacles of the Zionist lobbies and the deep state. So navigating us through the Fourth Reich matrix or the World Economic Forum's Fourth Industrial Revolution, it is local freelance journalist from Bristol, Joe Banks, and also Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. So, looking this week, we've got to obviously have a look at Elon Musk and his interview with the BBC, some bits of which the BBC seem to prefer to others, much prefer it if they can just put the whole thing out, stick it up on their YouTube channel or whatever, so that people can see it warts and all. But of course, they've done lots of edits of it, several edits of it, all of which don't show the embarrassing bits where the BBC are made to look stupid. And I, for one, looked at that interview thinking, this is the BBC committing suicide by putting a rookie reporter in front of a extremely knowledgeable and media savvy interviewee. So, anyway, I thought there were a few good questions, one or two. But I mean, for example, he's asking Elon Musk about the people he's sacked at Twitter. Well, it's a bit of a boring question, really, because if Musk hadn't sacked these people, if you look at the books, the Twitter books, you'll see it was going to be shut down. So, you know, anyway. So, not the greatest interview in the world, but we've got a couple of highlights from that. Also, Friends of the Earth lose their appeal against the planning permission given to the new coal mine up in Cumbria, Whitehaven. Friends of the Earth seem to just waste their money on trying to stop things that should be going ahead. And we'll hear tonight what the main argument was that won the day at the High Court. So also there's a challenge in London to the ULEZ. That's the so-called clean air charge, where we heard from one of the London councillors a few months ago that actually the air is getting cleaner all the time and there's no need for it. On the subject Martin loves so much, which is King Charles's coronation, should he be coronated? Well, actually, we've got a bit of an alignment between Neil Oliver and Martin Summers here, maybe, because Neil is giving his opinion on that, just to put that video out a couple of days ago. I don't imagine that's the sort of thing he could get away with on GB News, but we shall see. In part two, we look at the JFK assassination on the theme of Robert F. Kennedy Jr. standing for president, which the mass media seem to be totally in denial about. They're not, you know, they rather it just went away and wasn't real and wasn't happening, especially since Sleepy Joe has been bumbling around making a fool of himself again this week, which we'll be hearing about again in part two. But we'll be looking at hypnosis this week and the connections between that and the JFK assassination and the RFK assassination and this guy Sirhan Sirhan. Another clip from Laura Guillenot's documentary about the links, what he believes anyway, the links between Israel and the Kennedy assassinations. And also, the big story of the week, I would say, it certainly is now, which is the Pentagon leaks. We will be hearing from James Bamford, who wrote a book called The Puzzle Palace, ex-National Security Agency chap. So, Iranian and Russian news banned in the UK, first by the telecoms cartel and then by Ofcom. Us cancelled off Bristol Community FM by the Bristol Mafia and a chap called Patrick Hart, the station manager. But not cancelled here quite yet. So, welcome to the studio, Joe Banks. Hi, Joe.
Hi there. Thank you for having me. It's very nice to see you both again.
I think we're going to just literally start with a look here at Bristol and... particularly, I mean, I think the reason I think this is an important thing to do, we look at all the international stuff as well, let's go right from one side to the other, is in a way we've got a microcosm here of what's going on in the wider world, you know, what's going on in other cities in Europe, other cities in Britain, particularly Britain though, because Bristol is a city which over the years it built up, particularly during the Industrial Revolution. There were all sorts of reasons for the city to be here, not least of which was the port, the harbour, shipping stuff in and out. That all moved out to Avonmouth and Portbury Docks, right, which is at the other end of the gorge to us here on the Bristol Channel. And of course, there's still quite a few ships that are not even interested in going there. They will go to somewhere like Harwich or another port around the country somewhere that even the Bristol Channel's a bit too small for them. So the city has kind of lost its reason to be so big and to be here. And in the meantime, there's quite a lot of land being freed up, isn't there, in the city, for all sorts of reasons, for the developers to kind of get their teeth into. And there's lots of money to be made doing this.
Yeah. The door has been opened to the developers in a massive way by the mayor of Bristol, Marvin Rees. And it's, something pretty... When you start getting a sense of the scale of what's going on in Bristol, it's pretty extraordinary last week, the Bristol University signed contracts with the construction company, Sir Robert McAlpine, for their... £500 million enterprise campus, which just forms one part of this enormous regeneration, this Temple Quarter regeneration scheme, which is the UK's largest regeneration scheme and one of the largest in the whole of Europe. And it just forms one part of this ribbon development that's ongoing or coming down the line, which runs all the way in the east. It's basically 3 miles long. It runs in the east from St. Philip's Causeway right across, pretty much following the line of the Avon New Cut, the river that was created at the start of the 19th century, along there to Cumberland Basin in the west.
The New Cut was a sort of bypass to the harbour, wasn't it? So the floating harbour was created.
Take the tide around the harbour.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So it goes from east to west. And this strip is 3 miles long of all these different developments, runs pretty much alongside that. And one of the major things is this Temple Quarter, which is the university, which is also the very controversial Temple Island site, which was going to be an arena, which the previous mayor had all lined up. And then that got overturned in this very stitched up way when Marvin Rees came in, and the arena then got pushed out to the northern fringes of the city.
You use quite moderate language most of the time. Stitched up.
Yes. No. I mean, yeah. Undeniably. Yeah.
What?
I mean, when you go through that whole process, all the information that's emerged through freedom of information requests, through the scrutiny that happened in the council. Oh, we can go into that now if you want.
Well, we can. That's, I think it's a good idea to explain that this is basically the industrial heart of the city. And St Phillips, for example, is all industrial area. As that industry, and maybe bring Martin, as the industry's been run down in the city, suddenly this has created all these opportunities. We had a very similar thing happening in London, didn't we, in the 1980s and 90s, early 90s, with Docklands. And so there are these zones where the planning rules are less strict, and they have a kind of a small group of people that will make planning decisions rather than the ordinary elected local authorities in order to try and speed up the planning process. And that kind of thing is going, I think you used to call it the development corporations or something, where they would bypass the democratic planning system in order to get big developments done on old industry.
Enterprise zones
now. Yeah, okay. Well, that was, I'm afraid I'm using 1980s speak here.
Well, and that came from what George Osborne.
So Martin, what's going on here? We've got a city that's sort of lost its reason to be here through industry and through bringing all those people together for industry. But all it seems to be able to do now, what we seem to be seeing, is this being used just as the transforming of land into property, which is used for anything but industrial. Either here, like you've got student accommodation, luxury housing and that sort of thing. So it's a complete change, really, in the emphasis in this part of the city.
Well, I don't think there's an enterprise zone in Bristol, is there? It's the council that's decided all
this.
No,
it's an enterprise. It's Temple Quarter Enterprise Zone.
All right, so it's been made into an enterprise zone.
Yeah, George Osborne. That was announced back in 2012 by George Osborne.
Okay, well, I didn't know that. Well, I mean, obviously, what these enterprise zones are, I mean, what happened in the Isle of Dogs and Canary Wharf and all the rest of it, this was a rundown Docklands area. And it's a very well-established thing now for those areas to be completely transformed into high-end property development. Because living near a harbour or working near a harbour is very desirable. You know, back in the day when these places were ports, they were rather ne'er-do-well sort of places. And the studies have done that they put walls around the London docks so that everybody could be checked going in and out to make sure that the dockers weren't thieving everything off the ships. And of course that was, you know, part of the sort of struggle that went on back in the 19th century. But of course, with containerisation, those old harbours and ports all over the world have now become, available for development. And the kind of development which has been very successful in terms of making money for some people elsewhere, like Docklands, that's exactly presumably what they're thinking about doing here in Bristol.
Well, that's the industry's gone too, hasn't it? There used to be things like Bristol buses, making buses, shipping them around the world.
Bristol had a fairly diversified economy compared to somewhere like Liverpool. So, I mean, obviously the docks in Liverpool, there's hardly any ships going to Liverpool now. I mean, you see the occasional cruise liner coming in, and the dock side itself has been transformed into, you know, luxury housing and so on. And it's quite attractive. It's just, it's not the same as it was. But of course, if you go to Liverpool, and I was there not long ago, it's not as prosperous as Bristol because, as I say, the economy is not as diversified. Bristol has always had quite a diversified economy with some light industry and various other things going on, university and all the rest of it. I mean, in a way, you know, having a university development park, you know, where they're going to try and get the science departments of the university to develop new products is not necessarily a bad idea. But of course, underlying all of this is the big rip-off that is the property market in this country, where, it just rises in price but through land banking and other manipulations. I mean, that should all be really captured by taxation. It shouldn't be going to the private pockets of private people.
It's the it's high-tech industry in Bristol that's really being pushed now.
Yes, and of course, that makes sense in a way, doesn't it? Because, we're not going to be building steam engines anymore around here, you know.
Yeah, but the university is then becoming an arm of that.
It's quite clear that universities are a key entrepreneurial function. They used to be sort of ivory tower places to some extent, but they're not anymore because most modern products are the result of scientific research. They're not somebody tinkering away in their garage. Mm. And that's the whole point, is you try and... I mean, it's not in principle a bad idea. It's just a question of how you put it into practice. And there's probably lots of other things going on there. You know, luxury flats, for example, for which there's much less justification.
Yeah. Okay, so, so the area is called Temple Quarter. It's just on the end of Temple Meads Station. I'm not sure what the final platform is called at Temple Meads. It must be platform 12, 13 or something, right at the very end.
And they're putting three more entrances into Temple Meads as well.
Yeah, so they're going to transform the station a bit, but there's a whole area around there. So you use this word, stitched up, or this expression, to describe what happened at Temple Island. And that I find... And it particularly interesting because this was a site which had been cleared with the promise of a sort of, well, basically a public event space obviously it's a paid for thing, so people have to pay to go. It's not all free or anything, but it was going to be an exciting public space right next to Bristol Temple Meads Station as a sort of way of saying, well, we've got all this land, masses of land here, a lot of it is public land, and we're going to make sure at least some of it is going to be used by the Joe Public. And it makes a lot of sense, doesn't it, to have it next to the station so people can come to a concert, a gig, whatever it is they're going to there, a rally by a evangelical, religious person or something. It could be anything. Yeah. But then they can hop in the train and they can go back home, you know, back to Weston-super-Mare, Chippenham or wherever it is on the train, and it's a very sensible place to put it. But no, so why do you use that expression, stitched up? What happened there?
Well, when you look at the way it was done and the people that did it and the way it was done, it was done in a very unaccountable way. You've got this Malaysian global infrastructure company, YTL, who already owned the old aircraft hangars, Brabazon aircraft hangars in Filton.
Let's stop you for a second, because that would have been BAE Systems land that they would have sold to them, because BAE Systems inherited Filton Airfield, and this is 10 miles or so north of Bristol, isn't it? This is up in South Gloucestershire.
It's right on the border of South Gloucestershire, yeah. And you had things going on like... So Marvin Rees, the mayor of Bristol, was flown from... He was on a visit to China in late 2017. He was then flown to Malaysia to have meetings. He was put up in the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Kuala Lumpur.
Very nice, yeah.
Had all where I think Obama had stayed previously.
The Bilderbergers used the Ritz-Carltons quite a lot as well. Yeah.
And had all his meals paid for. This was all paid for by YTL. And in the background, you've got people working for Bristol City Council who had previously worked for YTL. And they got to a situation where they wanted to give the go ahead to this arena in the north of Bristol. But they had to get past something called the sequential test in planning, which means that if you've got an area available in the city centre, that has to have primacy over an outer town or
out
of city.
Because our previous mayor, George Ferguson, had actually deliberately scheduled several chunks of land, saying, well, I don't know what's going to happen in here, but I want it to make sure it's public. For example, one right on the dockside, which has been sold for development as a hotel, Ferguson made sure that it was supposed to be there only for a public, something like a museum or that sort of thing. If someone wanted to build a museum there, it was guaranteed for that. But we've seen that whole thing overturned, and now that being sold off for a hotel. So there's been a mass privatisation by this Labour mayor of quite a lot of things. So now we're going to get, what are we going to get on Temple Island?
Well,
this is actually a little bit of land which is not really an island. It's just got a great big wall and a road which cuts it off, and it but it does have the new cut, which is sort of the River Avon running along one side of it. And there was this famous bridge built across. In fact, there's two bridges built across, one pedestrian bridge and one road bridge, which are known locally as the Roads to Nowhere, because they've been there for something like a decade now, and yet nothing's been built. The roads have been built, all the basic infrastructure for something to happen there has been taking place, but no development so far.
Well, what the officers in Bristol Council had to do very quickly was get a deal with someone to take on that land, get that sort of sealed up, and then they would be able to get permission for the arena at Filton. So they quickly did a deal with Legal and General, to use that land, and gave them this fantastic deal, where Bristol City Council would spend £32 million getting the land ready for them. Legal and General would have a 250-year lease, and Bristol City Council would guarantee rent on the office space for 40 years.
Well, this is a bit cheeky, because Marvin was selling this idea of the arena, saying, well, actually, we don't want to do the arena because the City Council might be liable at some point in the future. Well, obviously, you know, the City Council might be liable with this Legal and General deal too.
So what's going to be there is a conference centre, a 345-room hotel, 550 new homes, and these two Grade A office buildings, and there's a bit of land there that's also owned by the university that will be student accommodation.
But surely that's quite a good thing to have there. The students are going to enjoy being next to the station, aren't they?
Yeah. That also opens up another question of what the university involvement was in this whole deal, because initially, when it was going to be an arena, quite a bit of that university accommodation was going to be on their site, their enterprise campus site. And then when this whole deal went through, they then put all their student accommodation onto Temple Island. So it seems to me that it would have been in their interest for this not to have been an arena as well. And they're such a powerful player in this whole enterprise zone.
Yeah.
Although, you know, publicly they've said that they said all along, we have no preference. If the city wants an arena or doesn't want an arena, we don't mind. But it seems to me they must have been involved in working this all out as well.
How come the university's become such a major player in the city? In the way, in the past, it was sort of sitting in the background. It's got loads of its old buildings. If it wanted some new space, it usually would do something like either buy a little piece of land or else knock down an old building, put up a new one.
Well, they've always been fairly major players in the city.
Well, they're expanding massively here.
Well, of course, I mean, yes, because the kind of incentives that are on university managers now, they need to expand in order to function, because they've got to bring in foreign students to pay the fees, because the caps on student fees and the fact that many students don't actually pay the money back.
They're
becoming more commercially oriented.
Right, well, exactly. This is another side of all of this, where the university is saying that they are now expecting an increase of nearly 5,000 new students every year, Joe.
They've had an increase of 10,000 over the last 10 years.
Right, and another 5,000 now.
Yeah.
So is the idea that these people come because they're getting a brilliant education here and they're getting it in English, and that English is a good language to get your education in?
Well, absolutely. I mean, it's one of the selling propositions for people to come here and study is two things. A, that it's in English, and many people learn English in school wherever they come from, China included. And
it's a way to top up your English, isn't it, as well?
Oh, yes, of course. I mean, and then, of course, the other thing is, I mean, when the government were negotiating, for example, with Narendra Modi about some potential trade deal with India, one of the things that he was demanding is that students who come here to study should be allowed to stay and work afterwards, because then they can put remittances back to India and so on and so forth. And this is globalization. This is what it looks like. And, of course, that does create huge problems for local people who are trying to get somewhere decent to live. If you've got very wealthy students coming from outside who are going to bid up the prices for property.
one of the criticisms of this, Joe, is a great article in the Bristol Cable. I'll put a link up to on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. They're talking here about pseudo-public space. So, I mean, admittedly, the arena is a kind of, it's a bit like a football stadium, you know. It's not public space, it's nearly public space. But the university isn't really going to have much of an interest there for ordinary citizens in Bristol. And that's the basic point that they're making in the Cable, is they're saying, well, there was something that everybody might have, well, have been going to. The university is not like that.
No, well, and it's legal and illegal in general as well. And they, you know, they come out with all this very, very friendly stuff about what their intentions are, how they want to, you know, be a place for the whole city. You can't help but being a bit sceptical about that.
Well, what they're also saying is this, you know, that as people, I mean, I'll just read a little bit of the article. She said, it says, on a spring day last year, Heidi Severade was walking her dog with a friend through Temple Quay in central Bristol. Stopping by the river for coffee, the pair were enjoying a brief bask in the sun when a private security guard came out of an adjacent building and told them to leave. Confused as to what her crime could possibly be, 39-year-old Heidi asked the security guard why they weren't allowed to drink coffee in what was a public area by the riverfront. The security guard told her the site was private and they had to move on. There's something very uncomfortable about being turned away like some sort of nuisance when you're just standing around unaware that you're breaking any laws, she said.
Yeah. So, so this is happening all over the city as well. That's happening at, I've spoken to you before about the St Mary LaPorte development. And you can see in the emails, the Freedom of Information emails there, that they're talking about the land deal, you know, that they're making with the developer. And that's on the edge of Castle Park. And that, and they, you know, they talk about, they talk up public realm. You know, this is going to have great improvements to public realm. But the actual, the fact of it, you know, it's absolutely not public realm, it's private realm. And ultimately they can, they can stop you doing, they can stop you being there if they don't want you to be there.
Martin Fodor is a Green councillor in Bristol, one of the best. Used to be on our show very regularly when we were in BCFM, Martin. He's saying finding a preferred partner is well established, but a deal signed behind closed doors is not the same process as running it as an open tender, he says. Green councillor for Redland, he sits on a number of these various scrutiny commissions. He's saying, actually, this deal was handed to Legal in general. There was no proper public bidding process for it at all.
Well, you'd have thought that the Greens set fair possibly to take control of the council come, not this May, but the following May. Mm. But of course, no doubt by that stage, all of this stuff will already be...
These major property deals will be done.
It'll all be done, so that even if they wanted to change their minds about it, they can't. But I think it is, you know, obviously the Green Party, who are becoming a bigger force in the city, might not have signed a lot of this off. And of course, that's the argument for having a mayor, you see. So instead of having all these endless arguments about we're not doing that and we're not doing that, and there's objections here and objections there, you can just bulldoze it through. Mm. Isn't that the whole point of having a mayor?
And you have people, so the person who did sign that off was a guy called Colin Moulton, who was the, who came in 2017, basically to oversee that what was happening with the arena. And he had been, prior to that, he had been the chief executive at Homes England, or the Housing and Communities Agency, which is the an arm, a sort of a body, a government body that's looking to increase housing, a kind of housing accelerator. He came into Bristol City Council in 2017 after receiving a redundancy payment of £95,000 from Homes England. He was then on a self-employment contract, which meant that he was being paid £263,000 a year.
Well, I do hope that his contract was being paid to a company in the Cayman Islands, and then he was then using that company to pay himself, because then he wouldn't have had to pay any tax at all, which is what a lot of these people who are in on these kind of freelance contracts with the council, that's what a lot of them do.
Well, talking about the Cayman Islands, YTL... are also in the Cayman Islands.
This is the developer, Malaysian developer.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny, isn't it? Well, I mean, you know, you might wonder, well, why is Malaysia in charge of all of this, you know, owning all this land? I mean, this is just a bit of a joke, really, isn't it? But if you look at Malaysia, you'll see over the last few years there's been a whole load of financial corruption over there with this one MDB scandal. $3 billion, Goldman Sachs have been told they've got to pay over that. It's been one of the places over the last few years which is in the centre of corruption. And this is where the there were various arrests made, including the former Prime Minister and former, well, I don't know what they call it in Malaysia, but Chancellor in Malaysia, arrested because the government were actually complicit in this. Well, it looks to me like what we've got here is we've got big developers making a lot of money with our elected representatives complicit with this.
Yeah, and there's this merry-go-round of people who were going in and out of the public sector, going from the public sector to the private sector. There was another Bristol City Council officer, Barry McRory, who was... another senior city council boss overseeing the arena who went...
Sorry, he was a councillor or was he
an officer? No, this is an officer.
An officer, right.
On 136 grand a year.
Wow.
And he left Bristol City Council in 2017 to go and work for YTL. and now he's working for the university. You know, so it's this merry-go-round.
So the reason we're talking about this is the shovels have just been stuck in, haven't they, this week?
Just signed contracts.
Into Temple Island to actually start building this. And, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm sure you've had a good look at the plans, Joe. I mean, it doesn't seem to me as if you could even cram another skyscraper on there. What they've done with it is rather than sort of keep it in keeping with the surrounding area, and it's actually slightly higher than, for example, the parts of St. Philip's, the other side of the new cut, is to put skyscrapers on it. I mean, it doesn't look to me as if this is in any way trying to make it look reasonable as you're viewing it from the surrounding area. It just looks like the same old, how high can we build up? How many square feet of floor space that we can then rent out can we put on here?
Yeah. It's a feeding frenzy, isn't it?
I mean, it really does look incredible. I will promise to put up a picture on our show page at thisweek.org.uk of the projected development, because it really looks, it's so ugly and it's ridiculous. If you can imagine a little part of the city, a bend in the river, and then getting a whole load of Lego bricks, about 10 Lego bricks high, and seeing how many you can cram into that small area. That's what they've done. Yeah. Martin, I mean, it does seem like there isn't really any planning system anymore. It's a kind of free-for-all here.
Well, it was always weak, but it's got weaker and weaker. And people still think, you know, if you talk to people in pubs and so on, they still think that the council in some way controls this stuff and that they make decisions about it. Whereas in actual fact, I work for the council briefly. My experience would be that the developers pretty much run the show and the council's opposition is relatively... muted. Even if the council was run by the Greens and they wanted to oppose all of this, they'd still find it quite difficult because the law is against them. You know, the law in Britain is that developers should be allowed to develop unless there's a good reason not, rather than we're not going to change anything until we can be sure we want to change it. And that's always been the case in Britain. We're a buccaneering sort of a place, aren't we?
It's been, you know, turned up to the max in Bristol.
Oh yeah.
To the point where things are going on. You've got the councillor, Nicola Beach, who has the responsibility for strategic planning in the city. She worked for a PR consultancy for developers before she came into Marvin Rees's cabinet.
Well, perfect PR,
You've got another Labour councillor, young Eastfield councillor, Marley Bennett, who about 3 months ago started working for Turley, a full-service planning and development consultancy, who were actually one of the consortium of consultants who did the master planning for Temple Quarter and, are deeply involved in getting stuff through planning, for developers in Bristol all over the country. And this guy sits on the Growth and Regeneration Scrutiny Committee. It seems to me things have got very, very bad indeed.
Well, yeah, particularly you've got the poachers turn gatekeepers. That's
in a democratic sense.
Councillors are supposed to be the poachers, aren't they?
They're supposed to have some independence. If you've got someone there who's working for, a planning and development consultancy, then that person won't be employed if he's any kind of threat to that business's clients. And you have to have people, democratically elected people, who are prepared to threaten the interests of developers. That's not to say they've always got to oppose them, but there will be occasions where the interest of the developer does not align with the public interest.
Just looking at again at this business of the arena moving from right next to Temple Meads, which is the obvious place to put it, as George Ferguson said, really central, easy to get to in and out, and even people who live in central Bristol can just walk there. But no, we're going to have it up at Filton Airfield because that's where our people own some land, and they're going to. I mean, they did exactly the same, and I say they. I mean, the City Fathers, who I was on the Cultural Development Partnership with back in the late noughties, and we had a wrangle at the time saying, well, what you're going to put this aerospace museum in Filton, how are people going to get to it? Who's going to see it there? Who's going to go to it? And do you know what's happened now? It's nearly bankrupt because it's run out of money. There's nobody going to the Aviation Museum up there. I think it's called Aerospace Bristol, and they're just hoping that by piling, I think, more and more and more activities up there, that hopefully people will start going to Filton. But the fact is, Filton is right at the top north end of the city, and the communications around there are awful. So these people have just decided, well, we're going to do all this stuff in the place where the land is convenient to do it. And actually what's happened, Martin, is the planning system has completely gone out the window. There's no strategic planning in here whatsoever. It's all just about money.
Well, if you look at the whole development of Aztec West in the 1980s, that's because of the M4, M5 interchange there. And in previous era, they wouldn't have been allowed to do anything with it. But in the Thatcher era, they just said, well, do what you want with it.
Well, that's right. What's happening now,
A whole new city almost grew up around Aztec West.
Well, apparently cars are going out.
There was no kind of thought about what infrastructure is required or anything.
Apparently, the internal combustion engine and the diesel engine are going out of fashion. And yet, all along our motorways, you're seeing more and more and more development taking place. Chippenham, another massive...
Well, what happened to Swindon? I mean, it used to be a kind of run-down little train town.
So the motorways are going to have all these...
The most developing, the fastest growing town in Britain.
Well, you can look and see where the people are buying up land alongside motorways.
Another aspect of the YTL Arena thing is that actually they are getting all this public transport infrastructure put in for them to get people to their arena, which is being paid by the West of England Combined Authority.
So people come in to get to Temple Meads on the train, and then they'll get
something else that will take them to
the arena.
Yes.
Well, I mean, this is a total waste. It seems public money is just spent on, this is Martin. This is
partnership.
Well, no. This is corporate welfare.
Can
I mention Colin Skellett?
Yeah, please do. Yeah.
So this is another. I just find it absolutely mind blowing. How interlinked these people are. So Colin Skellett is the chief executive of Wessex Water. The company who are polluting the River Avon that runs through Bristol. He's also... Wessex Water is owned by YTL, and he is the chief executive of the YTL UK group of companies, which includes the arena complex of Filton. He's also the chair of Business West, which is the big business lobbying group in the west of England. And he was also, it's worth mentioning, in 2002 he was arrested in a Dawn raid at his home in Bath on suspicion of accepting a £1 million bribe during the takeover of Wessex Water by YTL, which I should say he was cleared of all charges.
Of course. Venturer?
Yes, I believe so.
See, this is in a way, this is really, I think, what's going on. I mean, for example, Wessex Water, as we were discussing a couple of weeks ago, Martin, was privatised in the Thatcher years. And so much of what we're seeing now is a result of those Thatcher years, isn't it?
It is, because if the water companies were not privatised, then they couldn't be part of this merry-go-round that's being described.
I think Bristol Water was one of the only private water companies in the country.
No, Bristol Water has always been private, and still is, but Wessex Water...
That's where you'll find these merchant ventures.
And it was taken over ultimately by Enron. So when Enron went bust, Wessex Water were implicated in that. And of course...
Yeah, we mustn't complain too much, but both Joanne and I are taking a sip of the stuff, right?
It's delicious.
I totally take on board that all the detail that's coming out here about how corrupt this is, but the overall structure of things means that it's facilitated. And of course, after 30 or 40 years of just going do what you like, this is what you end up with.
One last point. I've got to make this last little point. So, I think it illustrates the depth of the problem. I wanted to make a complaint to Bristol City Council about the fact this councillor is working for a planning and development consultancy while he's on the Growth and Regeneration Scrutiny Committee, because it's a very obvious conflict of interest.
Absolutely.
And I was initially told by the monitoring officer, the person responsible for overseeing probity within the council, that it's down to the councillor to recuse himself if they feel there's a conflict of interest, where evidently there's going to be a conflict of interest in anything they do on that committee, because everything is connected to the environment in which these developers operate. And so I thought, okay, I discovered that there's a subcommittee at Bristol City Council, an ethics and values subcommittee. Maybe I could get in touch with them, get in touch with the chair of that committee. Subcommittee. Yeah. Surely they would be interested in this sort of conflict of interest. I looked the person up, and who are they but none other than a director of Business West? So it's this sort of Kafkaesque situation where you got nowhere to turn. There's no democratic.
Well, it'd be interesting to put in a complaint anyway and see if it gets anywhere. But this whole issue of probity, there isn't any. Let's just be frank. There is no probity in this city anymore. And one of the things that should happen and does happen occasionally is that the opposition councillors scrutinise. Is there any sign of that going on?
Well, I think that I find that disappointing. I find the Greens pretty disappointing in their inability to actually hold the administration to account, and I think that's partly because there just aren't. I mean, the system, the mayoral system, doesn't give them much opportunity to do that. But I find that the level of debate, the ability of people to put an argument together in the council chamber is pretty weak.
Yeah, well, there's we have two main events, don't we? We have the cabinet, which is Marvin Rees chairing, and there's a certain amount of scrutiny of his cabinet. It's his little handpicked bunch of people that get paid a bit more than the other councillors.
There's no scrutiny of that within the cabinet. I mean, they're all handpicked.
They just nod away,
and they just nod things through.
But the full council is actually chaired, I think, reasonably well by the Lord Mayor, whereas Cabinet is a particularly nasty arena in this city. And I thought it'd be interesting to have a listen. We were talking about Martin Fodor and his sterling work, the Green Councillor, in questioning what's been going on at Temple Island earlier. And I think this is maybe one of the reasons why we don't get much questioning like this, is because I'm going to play you a clip now of a recent cabinet meeting with the Mayor, Marvin Rees, chairing the meeting. And the clip starts with one of his friends, Dave Regwell, who's been around for a long time, I've got to know. He's got very close to the city fathers. And to see the way Marvin Rees deals with him, and whether or not he's, this is the chair, remember, and of course the flavour of the city is really set by whoever chairs the council, and you can get a pretty clear flavour of why people don't necessarily want to ask the mayor difficult questions at cabinet. And so the first what we'll be hearing is Marvin Rees, and then we'll hear a selection of little clip where it's a quite long clip where the councillor for Redland, the Green councillor for Redland, Martin Fodor, attempts to ask a question at cabinet with Marvin Rees, the mayor, chairing it.
I'm letting you have another statement there rather than a question, but you are Dave Regwell, so that's okay.
Of course, also park groups, which was
right,
specifically...
Can we do the question, please?
Yeah. What arrangements are there
before
from...
You do answer, I do just... There's a bit of a... This is a political chamber, and so we do have to talk about... you do realise you didn't actually support the budget. We don't need to get into it now, but it's only real support if you're actually involved in the decision that allocates the money. It's not real support if you just identify the money, but then don't vote for that money to be put into the budget. And if you don't support the budget, you have not actually supported the spending that the council is going to do. And I mean, because I get your point about all the support that was in the chamber, but that didn't actually happen because one of the parties didn't support the budget at all. And it's important that we do that because this is a place in which we make serious decisions in a complicated city in the face of competing demands under incredible financial pressure. And making those decisions, you can't always take the easy line of saying what you believe without actually making decisions about where the money's going to get spent and where the money's not going to get spent. As Joe Biden said, don't tell me what you believe, show me your budget. If you haven't got a budget, there's no evidence of what you believe. That's the easy route, and it's not serious political leadership in the city. But having said that, Ellie, please, would you like to respond about how people will be involved in that? Okay, do you have a supplementary, but please make it a question?
Yeah, I think suggestions that come forward for this particular
please,
piece
Martin,
of
can
money.
We have a question?
I'd like to know if you intend to keep any proposals that come for this piece of money, because there is the second capital spend coming, so they
will,
are
will you keep the proposals that come from this money, I think is the question.
So that's an incredible bit of chairing, supposedly chairing there, not actually allowing Martin Foda to ask his question. And the long and short of it is, well, you didn't support the budget, so how can you ask a question about what's happened with the budget? You can't. You're not allowed to. I'm not going to allow you to. I'm the mayor. I'm in charge. It doesn't come across very well, Joe, actually, to have somebody, I mean, literally, he's been accused of bullying by many people, but he's not a chair who's trying to bring in all views, hear all views, and tease out a consensus. He's already decided that certain questions are hostile questions, and are not going to be allowed to be asked, even though this is supposed to be a democratic forum.
Yeah, I find his approach very, very uninspiring, and particularly hypocritical, because he's always giving these pompous lectures about people bringing the debate down in the council chamber and the lack of nuance and he's constantly attacking the tone of opposition councillors.
I don't think he really understands opposition, Martin. He's even quite cheeky there with that Green councillor, Martin Fodor. He's saying, well, actually, no, that's not the question. I'll tell you what your question was, and this is what it was.
Well, obviously, I didn't hear the... Obviously, I heard the clip, but I wasn't... obviously, the background to it all is somewhat opaque to me. I think the fundamental problem is the mayoral system. It gives anybody... I mean, George Ferguson was the mayor, he chose to have a more consensual style, but that was entirely up to him. He didn't have to do that. And the problem with the mayoral system is it really is designed as originally thought of. The Tories thought of it on the back of a fag packet.
Is he a sort of CEO then?
Yes, that's exactly how he sees himself. And did you see he mentioned Joe Biden there? Because he sees himself, because he's married to an American, he studied at US universities, he sees that this is the way things are done. You know, he sees himself as a kind of reincarnation of Mayor Daley or something of this sort. That's how he sees himself. And of course, incidentally, I'm a member of the Labour Party, and I perhaps shouldn't say this, but he's probably going to be the Labour candidate in Felton. So having
which
provides some work for locals who might vote for him, well, that wasn't necessarily being against his interest, would it? But I mean, he would just say that's hardball political stuff. That's what they do in the US. That's what we've got to do. We've got to be more like the US. I don't agree with that, but they see where he's coming from.
I would also suggest, if anyone's interested in following what's going on here in Bristol, we've got a very good freelance journalist whose name is Joanna Booth. She is the wife of the editor of one of the local papers, and it's at least an online paper. It was started by an ex-Bristol Post journalist using his redundancy money. And it's extremely good to have, as many organs as we can here scrutinising what's going on. But Jo's Twitter handle is StillAwake. That's @StillAwake if you want to follow her. But we can round up, I think, by looking at the... Plans to demolish Bristol Centre NCP car park for tower blocks moves forwards. Developers describe it as a run-down building in a neglected part of town, but some are saying that they want it to stay, this car park. Now, of course, this is another side effect of the Clean Air Zone and people being charged to bring cars in, is suddenly all these car parks, we can knock them down and build a skyscraper.
Yeah. Yes, yeah, so this is a sort of brutalist car park, but some people see it as a...
So this is a style of architecture, yeah?
Yeah, brutalism. And this that whole area along Rupert Street and Lewin's Mead was all, rebuilt post-war. Some people see something quite attractive in that particular...
Student accommodation going in there. Surprise.
Well, what I was going to say is that they're actually, managing to make this very grim part of Bristol even worse, which is quite an achievement.
This is another side effect, isn't it, of these policies? We're told it's all about clean air, Martin, but actually, oh dear, there's all these... I mean, there's one of the car parks off Baldwin Street is about to be demolished. It's been closed. This is all development opportunities going on here. And I do wonder if there's really almost anything else going on in this country where people can make money other than knocking things down and building luxury flats.
Well, this is a point I was going to make, is this is all dependent upon lines of finance which are dependent upon international financial system remaining stable. And it may well be that we'll get halfway through building all this stuff and then the cranes will just grind to a halt. In fact, I predict that's what will happen.
Are you telling me that these international students aren't coming?
No, the international students will come. It's the finance for it which will fall down, because when the banking system is still incredibly unstable. People presume that it's all sorted since 2008, but what we saw happening in California and so on, and something like that will, in the very near future, I suggest, it may be, if it happens quickly enough, it'll stymie all of this.
Mm.
Well, which is probably a better result than getting halfway through with it and then being stymied. Yeah.
The whole scheme is meant to take up to 25 years, to happen.
Yeah, so, and there isn't going to be any downturn in the next 25 years. I think that's most unlikely.
The other thing is flooding as well, which is a big threat, because the whole thing, this whole ribbon, a mass 3-mile-long ribbon of development, most of it sits right, in the areas most at threat of flooding in Bristol.
Well, I suppose if you're on the top floor of these flats, that won't be such a problem, but you won't be able to get out.
Yeah.
There's another thing that they don't seem to have thought about at all, which is with all these extra students and all these extra luxury flats and even affordable houses, which don't seem to be being built at all anymore because there's not enough money in it for the land speculators. South Bristol GPs and schools won't cope with the 12,000 extra homes, claims MP. This is Karen Smith, another fairly regular guest on our BCFM programme. More than 12,000 new homes are either being built or planned for South Bristol right now, but the area's MP is calling for someone to own the problem. Make sure there's enough GPs, surgeries, healthcare centres and schools. Karen Smith has told Bristol Live, that's the Bristol Post local newspaper, the people of South Bristol do not have confidence in the huge numbers of new homes being built. So there's, on the one hand, Martin, you've got all these projected, we must have new homes, but they're not building the infrastructure to service them.
Yeah, and also when they say new homes, it's nothing, we're not talking about homes for poorer people, which is where the real issue is. The people who will come and live in those homes, if they get built and if they get sold, will be mainly from outside Bristol. The city will grow and become prosperous,
and
but it won't necessarily be for the locals who've been here all along. I mean, Bristol is a very successful city in many ways compared to other cities in Britain, but it's still got miserable deprivation in certain parts of the city, and that just goes to show that just boosting money into the city doesn't solve those fundamental social problems. It doesn't trickle down. It doesn't, a lot of this stuff is of no help whatsoever to people who are really struggling in Bristol. Mm. And of course, in the past, a Labour council in the 40s or the 50s would have had the powers to, planning powers, for example, to build council houses. And they would literally, the plan was, we're going to put council houses right next to middle class houses, right next door, and they'll all have to go to the same school. And that was the plan. That's what the conception was. And that's, town planning really meant something in that era. Obviously we got new towns like, Milton Keynes and so on being developed on greenfield sites. But even in the major cities, there was a general general belief in planning the city. Whereas what's happened now is they just said, well, just let the private sector do what it wants and we will facilitate the private sector. Mm. That's where we've got to.
Yeah, and we'll have totally meaningless affordable housing percentages that get pushed down and down.
They never get built. I mean, you know very well what happens with that. As soon as they get to building it, if there is, for example, a bit of a financial wobble, then they will just say, well, we did say we were going to build you some affordable housing, but now we can't do that.
It's not viable.
Yeah, or else. And they say, oh, that's all right.
Or else, as we saw here in the boatyard development, it starts to slide into the river because it's been built jutting out over the river and the river starts to subside beneath it. And so it's condemned.
It's always been a problem with social housing and council housing is it's been done on the cheap. The reason why tower blocks in the 60s were so unlivable in many respects is because they didn't spend the money on them. They were basically jerry-built.
Bristol City Council have come up with another solution, which happened this week, which was just to halve the social housing waiting list by just taking half the people off it, which is what they've done this week.
So how can they do that?
Because they've just said... social housing waiting list in Bristol was around 19,000.
Yeah.
And this week they've said that the people in the lower... there are four bands of need, basically. Yeah. And those in the lowest band, which is actually about half of that list, are just never going to get a property.
Well, they never were anyway, but at least they're being honest about it.
So they're actually just off the list.
Yeah. Oh, yes. So they've got a problem to solve now.
Many of these people will be have been on there for maybe even up to a decade. Because the story is in the various places, but it's also in Bristol 24/7. Many residents with low priority housing need are unlikely to find a new home. About half the 19,000 families on Bristol City Council's housing waiting list are being kicked off after bosses admitting them, giving them false hope of ever finding a home. Less than 1% of the 9,500 households considered at least urgent are allocated accommodation. There's little or no chance of being successfully housed in a report to the authorities' leaders. The city's social housing is advertised on the council's Home Choice website, which people on the waiting list can bid on, with those in greatest need usually awarded a property if it is suitable. In fact, I mean, I was involved in the consultation when they brought this in probably a decade or more ago. And we all pointed out the people on this little board they set up back in the old, this is in the Ferguson era, or maybe even just before the Ferguson era. So before we had a mayor, when they used to do things properly, and we were saying, well, look, just a minute, what about all the vulnerable people that are they going to be able to play this video game and sort of go online and try and click all the buttons in order to get somewhere to live? So basically what has happened now is what we warned of is the people who are most adept on computers and using the system, and Martin, are the ones that get the housing often.
That's right. It used to be allocated on need by the council. You know, there would be a list and they'd say, right, you've got three kids, they've only got two, you're first, you know, and there was no argument about it. And they used to give you, you know, this is what we've got to offer. I think you did have some power to say, I don't like this for whatever reason. But the thing where you've got to be computer skilled to bid, it's a marketisation of society, isn't it? Everybody is just learning how to play the game, and this is the whole thing about universal credit. You've got to be paid in monthly instalments, and you get all the rent in one, so you learn how to manage your money. Even though people who are vulnerable often can't manage their own money, they need the rent to be just paid for them so that they don't have to mess about with it. And they need not to be told that they should get weekly or two weekly payments. That's why it used to be. The reason for having weekly, two weekly payments is because we know that people have chaotic lives and they can't manage their money. But Ian Duncan Smith's big idea was, we're going to get them all to become little entrepreneurs. It's like, they're disabled. They're never going to do any serious work. They've got to learn how to work. It's just ideology. And of course, what's really... This is what a Labour government could easily be like, is this stuff writ large. You know, Starmer has suggested some things which are reasonably radical, like putting GPs on the government payroll. But I bet you see this is what's going on in Manchester as well. There's a big... I didn't watch it. Maybe you did. A big BBC series about the developers in Manchester and how they've taken the place over.
Oh, yeah. Well,
and it's been very successful for them. Huge amount of money made. And Andy Burnham is just sort of presiding over this, like, I'm trying to help you, but what can I do, you know?
Yeah, well, it would be nice if Marvin Rees, our mayor, would actually even say, I'm trying to help you, but he doesn't. So funding scrapped and plans paused for electric buses and bike hangers in Bristol. Just sort of beginning to wind up our look at what's going on in the city here and the planning, etc. Because, I mean, this is 250 electric buses and 1,000 bike hangers have just been, the funding's been pulled for them. They're not having those anymore. So that's actually quite a lot of buses, 250 of them. The government has scrapped the funding. So we're being told that because of these emissions, the emission charge, that they want to get cars out of the city. But the thing is, Joe, it seems that the various alternatives, there isn't. I mean, we've had a massive cut in our bus services, etc. Hikes in the price of buses as well. And so just as people are being told you're not allowed to bring your car into the city anymore, so the public transport is either disappearing or becoming unaffordable. It just seems
perverse. It's very weird. It's one of the... And again, it's another one of these strange things about Bristol as a city, that it has, from the outside, it has this reputation as a fantastic, green, forward-looking, progressive place. You know, in some ways it is. But if you want to get a bus, it's just basically a lottery. You need to,
yes.
You know, you just never know when one will turn up, if it will turn up.
And even the little signs that tell you on the bus stop there's one coming, and then all of a sudden it's come, but there was no bus. So it's what they call the ghost buses.
Yeah.
Look, Martin, what's going on here? Because this is a bigger macroeconomic problem, surely, isn't it? There's just no government doesn't seem to have any money to provide for the services it needs. I mean, you know, the ultimate thing is here, you've got to go on your bike. But if you're elderly or if the weather's pouring down with rain, you can't go on your bike.
Yes, and also Bristol's got loads of hills. It's not like Oxford or Cambridge, is it, in terms of getting on your bike? Well, it's underlying all of this is the acceptance by the Labour Party, including Marvin Rees, that there's a kind of, you know, there are limits to what we can do, and within those limits we make noises about being inclusive and all the rest of it, but the reality is, the bottom line is, we've got to go along with all of this because what else can we do? And there isn't any willingness to challenge that. Now, obviously, if we had a Corbyn-led Labour Party, you might have seen much more kickback, but that's now been...
Well, the irony is, in the centre, the whole centre of Bristol is changing. You know, what you're seeing is quite a lot of shops closing down, but much more friendly space to walk around. It's just there doesn't seem to be so many people around. So if you go out into the city in the evenings, I don't know if you do this, you too, but I mean, I do it from time to time. Say even on a Thursday night, it's almost dead. You know, so it's almost like they're trying to pedestrianise the city centre, but the pedestrians, in the meantime, just don't seem to have the disposable income to go out and enjoy themselves anymore. Mm. Martin?
Well, I mean, the pubs and restaurants have definitely noticed the fact that there's people aren't spending money because of the cost of living crisis and all the rest of it. And all of this, you see, the macroeconomic environment will make any of this potentially unviable. It's nice having loads of chi-chi cafes with, £5 lattes if people can't go in them because they haven't got the £5.
You can walk along and you see lots of places shut now. In London, there's a much bigger, obviously there's a wider democratic remit there because you've got all the local London boroughs all with their local authorities. And the ULEZ, which is, does anyone know what it stands for? Emissions, ultra low emission zone, which is the extra charge that Mayor Khan, even though he did not say anything about this in his manifesto, is threatening to extend this right out to the M25 so that anybody that uses a car there is likely to have to pay this extra, whatever it is, £12 a day just to be driving around. Now, there is no alternative in many parts of this. And so the outer London boroughs of Bexley, Bromley, Harrow and Hillingdon, along with Surrey County Council, have launched legal action over the proposed extension of the ULEZ beyond the North and South Circular Roads. Hillingdon borders Buckinghamshire to the east of Denham. A judge at the High Court this week decided that their bid for a judicial review can go ahead, saying parts of the local authority's challenge were arguable. Sir Ross Cranston, in a written decision issued on Wednesday, said a one-day hearing should be held in early July. If it goes ahead, the ULEZ will see drivers in outer London pay, it's £12.50 a day from August 29th. Now, that, of course, means that if you go and visit somebody in London, that's £25 you've got to pay just to go and visit them, never mind everything else you pay. Now, this, of course, is going to try and drive people onto public transport. If you can get a train, if they're not on strike, and if you can afford to do that. So what do you make of this challenge, Martin? All these mostly conservative boroughs saying, look, locals here can't afford it. It's one of the things that I find so amazing about this is you've got Tories actually sticking up for people with less money. And actually what Labour's doing is it's going to, because the people who are going to be hit mostly by this £12.50 are the people who can less afford to pay it. Effectively, it's because as a flat rate, and also it's imposed more on older cars. This is a regressive tax.
Well, I'm not going to try and defend Doules. I don't really understand the ins and outs of it.
It's very similar to here in Bristol.
Well, I know.
Older cars have to pay it, and poorer people have to pay it.
Well, in that case, you've got to raise benefits and increase taxes on wealthy people if you want to do that sort of thing. Yeah, we should, for example, change our food production.
So why are these Labour mayors? Why are these so-called
messing up the rivers?
Why are these so-called Labour mayors bringing these measures in, which are mostly? I mean, the wealthy. This is just nothing to them. £12.50 a day, fine.
Why you'd have to ask Khan why he's brought it in. I'm not here to defend his position, but. Don't forget, and this is no doubt, this is what Marvin would say as well, we've had our budget cut by 60% in the last 5 years. We've got we really have taken a huge hit. It's the local authorities that have taken the biggest hit of austerity. Well, I drove past Trinity Road Police Station today, and there it is, a state-of-the-art police station built presumably by new Labour decision, and there it is, empty, and they're trying to sell it because it was closed down. You know, they'd opened it and then they closed it. And, of course, nobody wants to buy it for flats because it's got no windows. It's a police station. Mm. You know, ultimately, it'll have to be knocked down and something else will have to be
built. In fact, it's exactly the same as the police building on the opposite side of the road. That happened about maybe 10, 15 years ago. So they closed that one down and moved across the road. And now they're having to close that down too, apparently.
Well, I mean, what strikes me as absurd about that is it's a state-of-the-art, modern-looking police station. I mean, why go ahead and build something like that and then decide because of austerity, because we've got to bail the banks out and supply the Challenger tanks to the Ukraine, we can't afford a police
station? Well, maybe they're expecting civil unrest and that it's right in the city centre and that they might be attacked by mobs.
Well, I think what's going on is that there's plenty of money, as we found out during the pandemic. Rishi Sunak was able to press a button and nationalise the whole economy for months at a time. They just don't want it spent on things they don't want it spent on. The reason why they got rid of council housing is because people who lived in council housing, two things, they tended to vote Labour because they were grateful for getting a reasonable home, and B, they could go on strike. Of course, once you're buying your own house, you can't do either of those things so easily. And that's exactly why they did it. And of course, all of this is geared around political decisions. So another thing that's coming up in these local elections is people who haven't got a passport or a driving licence will be turned away from polling stations. Now, that's pretty disgusting to my mind. But of course, that is what's going to happen. And many people will turn up expecting to vote as they normally do, and they'll be turned away. I know people in this position.
That is in the next month or so, with the local elections.
That's right. And, of course, what they're hoping is, and they've also redrawn the constituency boundaries on the basis of the existing electoral registers, which if you've been an activist in any of the major cities, you will know loads of people aren't registered to vote. But the Tories don't care about that. If they don't want to register to vote, that's up to them. What they could do, quite straightforwardly, is just register everybody to vote automatically.
The thing is,
and in Australia, it's compulsory to turn up.
Just a minute. There's an absurdity to this voter ID, in that people, less and less people are bothering to vote anyway.
Well, indeed, the real problem is
we've got
very limited participation, particularly from the poorest and most marginalised people. They tend to be the people who don't vote because they think there's no point, nobody cares about us, and in a way, they're right. But, of course, we should be trying to make the system function for those people and make them see that. I mean, this is what Tony Benn said years ago. All you've got, if you are relatively poor, is your vote. And if you don't go and use it, then you're never going to get anything out of the society because they're not going to do anything for you. And, of course, they're deliberately rigging. And they're hoping that by doing this they'll manage to survive, you know, that there will be some kind of...
This is vote rigging, isn't it? But in this case, by the Electoral Commission. So what they're saying is, from the 4th of May 2023, just before the local elections, handily, voters in England will now need to show photo ID.
And their bus pass
won't do. Many people do not have photo ID.
Yeah,
probably about a quarter or even a third of the population do not have photo ID handy. Maybe a passport, maybe a driving license, whatever.
No, yeah, but you can't. Things like a pensioner's bus pass, which has got a photo.
How about my union card?
No, because it's got no photo on it.
It has.
All right, but it still won't count. Yeah, and so this has been brought in from the US, and I think it's going to be we must try and anybody who hasn't got any ID should turn up to the polling station and try and vote, because we want some figures on who was turned away.
Exactly. This will apply to local elections, police and crime commissioner elections, UK parliamentary by-elections and recall petitions. From October 2023, it will also apply to UK general elections. So very well done for bringing that up, Martin. It's unbelievable, really.
Is
there any evidence of widespread fraud?
No, there isn't.
Fraud?
In Northern Ireland, there used to be a bit of an issue about it.
What about postal votes?
They brought in photo ID in Northern Ireland already.
Can you send in
And what's happened is it's just pushed the... They tend to have fairly high turnouts compared to the rest of the country because it's a more stressful situation. But by bringing this photo ID thing, it's pushed down turnout in Northern Ireland. That's what it does. And of course, it's designed in the US. In the US, in many states, if you've got any kind of criminal conviction, you can't vote. So the police go around arresting young black males, for example, doing them for possession of marijuana. They can never vote again, ever. And that is quite deliberate. It's called voter suppression, and it's a standard. You know, Republican activists and corporate people, they spend a lot of time thinking, how can we weed through the electoral register? We want as few people on the electoral register as possible. And of course, if you think back historically, the voters were householders. They had to be householders. This was one of the main issues in the civil rights movement in Northern Ireland in the 1960s. At local elections, only householders could vote. So you didn't get a vote just for being an adult. You had to be a householder.
I think these things are, you know, possibly connected. You know, talking about the ULEZ, and you might throw in the cashless society as well into all of this. That what you're creating is a sense among people that there's a managerial elite who are, you know, imposing controls down through society that designed to shut people out.
Yes, and also people. If people were feeling alienated by that, then there might be some kickback. But what you also get is people going, "Well, that's how it's always been, isn't it? I mean, what can you do?" The sort of "what can you do" mentality.
Well, I wonder if things will boil up at some point.
Well, in France, we can see that things have boiled up.
Yeah.
They're right on, you know, I mean, nobody knows where this is going.
Yeah, but it's interesting.
They've reached the tipping point.
For anyone that didn't hear last week's show, have a listen to Sandy Adams, the full version of the interview I did with her last week. She takes us through a pretty, I think, interesting take on a lot of this, in that that a lot of these climate decisions, which were signed up to by the Ed Miliband Brigade and by the Tories at the time, people weren't really thinking about what the implications were for how it was going to affect our cities. And we've seen another kind of climate-related story this week, in that the Cumbrian coal mine legal challenge has been refused this week. The climate campaigners have been refused a legal challenge against the government over its decision to grant planning permission to a new coal mine in Cumbria. Friends of the Earth and South Lakes Action on Climate Change said they will ask the High Court to reconsider its refusal to grant a judicial review. In December, Levelling Up Secretary Michael Gove approved what's set to be the first new coal mine in Britain in 30 years. His department said it will be used for steel, not power generation, and supporters of the development have said it will create 500 jobs. Friends of the Earth and Slack said Mr. Gove failed to account for the significant climate impacts of the mine and whether carbon credits to offset its emissions would be accepted elsewhere. And we're going to hear now from David Douglas, who lives up that way, and he's a campaigner, ex-miner himself, coal miner, an ex-activist in the National Union of Mine Workers, Arthur Scargill's union, about all this. I think one of the... Just to kind of cut to the chase before we... I mean, in a way, you're stealing David's fire here. What he's explaining is this is a different type of coal that lends itself to coking to make steel with. And as I explained in the long interview, which I'll put up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, explains to me very clearly that back in prehistoric times, when people discovered that you could make charcoal, and this would make a hotter fire in order to forge steel, iron back in those days, and bronze. So coking coal is very similar. What you do is you cook it, and off various gases come, and the resulting coking coal is perfect for making steel. But anyway, so that there, I suppose a couple of things we're looking at here is, what is this coal mine? Why is it happening? And also, what is the what is going on with the British steel industry? So let's hear from David Douglas now, and hear his take, first of all, first of three clips, talking about the abolition of the British coal industry.
When they tried to actually get rid of the coal industry, which they did after the end of World War II, and Wilson made his white hot heat of modern technology speech, saying that it was nuclear now. We needed to get these miners out of these dark caverns with water dripping on their back and working in thin seams, because now we had nuclear energy, because Wilson, like many people, thought uranium grew on trees. He didn't realise that in Namibia and South Africa, our colleagues working in the uranium mines had radioactive water dripping on their backs, working working in desperate conditions, 10 times worse than coal miners did. You know, so, but when they tried to phase down the industry and depend it on Arab oil, in much the way that running down British energy meant depending on gas imported from Azerbaijan and Kazakhstan and stable places like that, and Russia, of course, the Arabs and the OPEC countries turned the oil off and left Britain with an energy crisis, and that was an opportune time for us to go on strike as well. But they realised that unless they wanted to be dependent on energy from abroad for everything that we do, the whole operation of the infrastructure of society and the economy, then you had to have your own source of energy. And we have abundant sources of coal somewhere in the region of 45 trillion tons of coal that's unmined.
Yeah, how long would that last, though, if it was being used?
45 trillion tons of coal, are you crazy? Yeah, probably about 2,000 years, 3,000 years.
So why, in your view, why have they decided that... I mean, I've just been reading recently about the Drax power station up in your neck of the woods somewhere, up north anyway. Yeah. Sorry to be such an ignorant southerner. But Drax used to be one of the biggest coal-fired power stations. It still has a reserve side of it, which can use coal. But now what they're doing is they are burning... trees and what they call biomass in there, much of which is imported from the United States, which doesn't sound very green. But what they're saying is that they are using something called carbon capture, and therefore it's not being damaging the climate.
Well, that's all bollocks. I mean, the Greens campaigned to turn Drax off coal, which was the last consumer of the coal from Callanly Pit, Hatfield Main Pit, which was my pit, and Thoresby in Nottingham. That was our sole market. We were supplying coal there at a price of £35 per tonne. It's currently imported at £285 per tonne, by the way. And the Greens lobbied, and they got what they called biofuel, which was, of course, trees. So most of the trees that are burned in the world are burned in Drax. And apart from using valuable land, which should either be wild jungle land and woodland, it's taken up valuable areas where we could be growing food. So we're burning the burning wood, which is imported, turned into pellets, and imported in super tankers right across the world, put on trains, landed at Immingham and run into Drax through devastated pit villages with closed mines to burn in the power station, which is in our backyard, and it produces more CO2 than the coal that we burnt. Now, Drax already had a carbon capture system called the White Rose Scheme, not as good as the one at Hatfield, but nonetheless would have taken out 40% of emissions, CO2 emissions from the coal, which is in our backyard. And the government pulled the plug on it. And then because of the realization of the absolute nonsense of burning trees instead of coke, it's far more CO2, then they do take out a portion of the CO2 now, not more than 40%, because the CO2 from the trees is far more polluting than the coal is. So it's just a nonsense. It's in order to make sure that the National Union of Mine Workers didn't come back from the grave and haunt them, and to kill the last vestiges of the National Union of Mine Workers and everything it stood for in terms of the trade union movement and working class militancy.
So that's David Douglas there. First of three clips from him on this decision to actually open. And it just seemed to me that anyone that's paid their subscription to Friends of the Earth must be kicking themselves, because what Friends of the Earth's argument is not that this coking coal shouldn't be burned. It's that it should be dug up somewhere else and imported here and then burnt, Martin.
Well, I'm not sure whether that is their argument.
The new mine won the argument at the High Court, you're saying that you can't do this in this country, but you can do it somewhere else. Well, where's the logic to that?
Well, yeah, if that is the logic, then there is no logic, as you say. I'm reminded of a few years ago, I went to a meeting with Tyrone O'Sullivan, who was the one of the leaders of the Welsh. South Wales NUM, and then he eventually was at Tower Colliery, and they made it into a cooperative. So it continued to exist after privatisation as a cooperative. It's gone now, and they've set up a development trust on the back of it. But anyway, he came to a meeting with a lot of climate change activists in the Cube, just down the road from here. And you know, they were all sort of young activists mostly in the room. Quite a big meeting. And he said to them, "Look, there are no enemies in this room. We're all on the same side. We're all trying to do the same things. But I put this to you: if you're going to build windmills, windmills are made of steel. And if you're going to build these windmills, you're going to need coke to make the steel. And coke is made from coal. Now, if we're going to have a transition." And, of course, there's a big question, should we have a transition and all the rest of it? But if you're going to have one, you've still got to make transitional steps. You can't just close down an existing infrastructure.
Nuclear power. Yeah, we've got nuclear power sitting there waiting to go.
Yes, nuclear power. But even if you've got nuclear power, as they have in Germany, the decision by the government in Germany, because it's the green influence in the government, is just to switch it off straight away. That doesn't make economic sense. The waste is still going to be there. You've got to deal with the waste. What you should do with all of these things is, if you're going to run them down in such a way that you can get the investment in them out of it.
So what are you going to do with the waste then? Fire it into outer space?
No, I'm against nuclear power, Tony. I'm not saying I'm in favour of nuclear power, but even if you want to get rid of it, you don't just switch it off. Yeah, that's silly. You've got to actually run it down in a planned fashion.
I found it very interesting the way David... I mean, I love him to bits, because he's bringing in the context of Arab oil as well into all the way that this policy has gone over the decades.
Yes, well, of course, the idea was that oil was going to be cheap and it was going to replace coal, because coal's old-fashioned, you know. But, of course, that turned out to be a load of nonsense, didn't it? For all kinds of reasons. I think...
This was a strategic deal we did, particularly with the Saudis, wasn't it? And with countries in the Middle East, the idea was, after the Second World War, we will buy them off with this massive amount of money that's going to come into their pockets through this.
Well, no, the real turning point was the OPEC oil crisis, in which, in actual fact...
1973.
Due to the Yom Kippur War, and the various Arab countries, including Saudi Arabia at that stage, said, because of this, and your support of Israel in this war, we're going to use our monopoly power, you know, the cartel power, to force the price of oil up. And, of course, in actual fact, there was already a deal having been done between, because don't forget, the dollar was taken off gold in 1971 by Nixon. And effectively what they did is they've linked the dollar to oil, and the price of oil the Saudis have just agreed not to buy, to sell oil, not just in dollars, but also in Chinese yuan. And of course, that's a potential game changer. Now, all of this kind of geopolitical stuff is actually very important, you know, where pipelines go, you know, where energy actually is, where is your energy infrastructure now?
Whether a tanker has been sunk by a submarine or not?
Well, that's exactly what we're talking about. So it isn't about general things about what sort of fuels would we like or not like, and it isn't about, you know, the free market. In actual fact, it's all stitch-ups and plans, agreements behind the scenes. So the Americans, because they got quite a lot of oil anyway, yeah, they were quite happy for the Saudis to push the price of oil up as long as they agreed to sell it in dollars and to recycle the money through buying arms from the Americans, the arms which are being used now to kill children in Yemen. And all of this stuff is what, you know, a lot of what goes on in the world is, look at the blowing up of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. That has actually, you know, kicked the European economy in the bees, if I can use that word.
You can, bees, yep, no problem.
And that is the Americans have gone out and done that. I feel like saying to Keir Starmer, Keir, the Americans have just decided to crash the European economy. Have you got anything to say about that? I don't believe that. It's like, no, I bet you don't.
No.
But it's the truth.
Anyway, let's get back
and to... And you want to be the Prime Minister.
Let's get back to David Douglas. I love his take on all this stuff. And as I say, there's an interview to the full interview will be up tonight on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, where here I put it to him that really what he was saying about being such a fan of coal was flying in the face of climate change.
You can't no more stop climate change than you can time or space. It's just part of existence. Now, whether CO2, man-made CO2, contributes to that, I don't know. But I would suggest that given there are nearly 8 billion of us on the planet, we have to make an impact. Humanity obviously makes an impact on the environment, but we live here too. You know, contrary to the Greens' dogma, human beings are not alien to this planet. Everything we do is natural because it's part of us, our existence. So we have a right to be here. Now, obviously, aesthetically, I mean, the Earth doesn't have any preference for woodland and trees as opposed to concrete jungles and skyscrapers. It's us who have the preference. We have an aesthetic preference, and part of our natural existence and evolution is in tune with nature and being part of nature. So we prefer trees and jungles and woodland and clean seas and stuff like that as part of our human existence. And we should minimize the damage that human beings do. The best way of minimizing the damage is through carbon capture and storage of coal. Coal production is rising throughout the world. It is a major, it is now the greatest source of energy in the world. Now, if you look at any graph for the development of places like India or China or Indochina, then the rise in living standards is directly associated with the consumption of coal and the production of coal. Now, you can tell people, don't burn coal, don't develop your coal, and send them subsidies and leave Africa and other developing nations and the scrap. India has a fifth of all the coal in the world. Half of its population has no electricity. How dare anybody in the West tell those Indians who have no power, who rely on camel dung and anything they can find and a mud floor hut to make enough food for their family, that they can't have electricity, running water, sanitation, and all the other things that come with a fuel economy that's based on the coal that's on their doorstep. How dare they do that?
Well, that's a very good point. And I think if the West wants these countries not to develop coal, then they have got to provide the resources for them to do it some different way, which means massive increases in taxes on the wealthiest people, complete change in lifestyle for the middle class in the West.
It's a bit similar to what we've been discussing here in Bristol.
And it's not viable anyway.
And the UK, this is a kind of authoritarianism going on here, both internationally in energy and here in Bristol.
Well, what it is it's an attempt to prevent these countries from developing because they're potential competition, China in particular. I mean, China is basically turning into the major competition to the Western powers. I think
China is still building coal-fired power stations. It's saying the right things at these various COP summits, but really it's saying, no, of course you're not going to stop us industrialising.
No,
forget
it. What they're saying is we've got to use coal to industrialise. So you, if you want to do stuff about climate change, it's up to the wealthy people in your society to make the sacrifices. Mm. And if you're not prepared to make the sacrifices, well, that's just too bad, isn't it? We're not going to stop developing our country. And of course, what's actually happening now with the breakup of the world into two big blocks is there's no agreement about anything. We're not going to agree with the Russians and the Chinese about climate change while we're at war with them. It's not going to happen. They're not going to play ball, are they?
The irony of this new coal mine in Cumbria at Whitehaven is that once they start pumping out the coking coal from there, and I was quite amazed to get this lesson about what this coking coal stuff is. Just like wood is burnt in a special way to make charcoal, coking coal is burnt in a special way to make coke. It's the same kind of stuff, but it's just on a much, it gets much hotter, you know, than the charcoal would have ever got. But I mean, I asked him, I said, well, look, what's going on? Because this coking coal, we might be digging it out of the ground, but will we have a steel industry left on the surface, since it's owned by Tata Steel in India and the Chinese Communist Party? Will it actually, well, I don't know, so I'm not sure if it may be a private company in China that owns it. It's China and India that own our steel. So will there be any steelworks left in a few years' time? I think it's going to take 4 or 5 years for the coal to actually start being produced from the mine. Will there be a steel industry left for this coking coal?
The whole policy, both of all of the political parties, is actually to get rid of British Steel in terms of new steel and leave us as a Steptoe's junkyard of the world, where we'll recycle everybody else's steel. So 70% of the steel in the world is new steel. In Britain, 70% is recycled steel. But that steel is very limited. You don't need coal and coke to recycle steel, because it's already been made using coal and coke. But there's not enough steel in the world to recycle. That would either meet with demands, and certainly not the conditions you need to create high tension, flexible steel needed, for example, for hundreds of foot wind turbines, or for high-rise flats, or for super bridges, or for any railway lines, or for anything of that kind. That needs new steel. Now, you cannot make it yourself. You can import it and pretend that somehow you're meeting the net zero target because somebody else is producing your emissions. Well, you know, this is a kind of utter nonsense, which we've heard from Friends of the Earth right the way through the 7 years they've objected to this mine.
So what's the schedule with the mine? When is this coal likely to come on stream and start being used to make steel in Britain?
It'll take, well, most of it now will go to Europe for the Germans in particular to make steel to send here for us to use, because we're closing down our primary steelworks. There may be two left by the time it opens, in which case we'll be in the position to supply them. But whether you make the steel here or you make the steel in Germany, you need the coal to do it. So we're looking at Friends of the Earth are still saying they're going to appeal against the decision not to allow them to appeal. I mean, they've really run out of options other than going to Lourdes or lobbying the Pope, I think. So it will go ahead. It'll take about 2 years before the mine is actually producing coal while the infrastructure gets developed. And I hope to be there helping to develop that infrastructure and, of course, recreating the National Union of Mine Workers at that pit.
Right. You mentioned a book. Can you just remind us of the title and how people can get hold of it, David?
The Coal, Climate Change and the Total Destruction of the British Mining Industry. Is becoming a very rare book. You can get it from The Word, which is the major library in South Shields, and directly from me at Douglas, with two S's, DouglasDavid705@gmail.com. It'll cost you £15 postpaid.
So that's the final clip from David Douglas there with his book about climate change and the demise of the British coal industry. It very up to date. And so the full version of that interview with David will be up on our show page later tonight at thisweek.org.uk. Overall, Martin, I mean, he's taking a sort of strategic view of the steel industry. I'm reminded of the coal and steel group, which was set up right after World War II to try and rationalise, what they called it, I suppose control is the other word, the coal and steel industry right across Europe, which was the beginnings of the European Economic Community, the EEC, and then the EU, just after World War II, set up under the auspices of some of the early Bilderbergers, and also the fact that the two massive German steel firms, Krupps and Thyssen, in the 1920s were some of the original funders of the Nazi Party. They thought the Nazis were great, and they even did a deal with them, saying that every single ton of steel that was sold in Germany, a certain proportion or amount, you know, marks or whatever, would be donated to the Nazi Party. So they were tied in very clearly, these industrialists, yeah, with the rise of Hitler.
Yes, and that is why the Adenauer and Jean Monnet originally conceived of the iron and steel deal, effectively between France and Germany, which was to prevent either of them. You know, it was designed to prevent war between France and Germany by making sure that everybody got something out of it in terms of steel and coal, and because they were regarded in this area as very fundamental to your civilization and your potential for making tanks and what have you if we're going to fight the Soviet Union. So the cartelization of the oil coal and steel industries was regarded as part of economic planning because they didn't necessarily believe in the free market.
But that isn't really planning. It's cartel, isn't it?
It's
cartels. What they do, Martin, I'm just sorry to interrupt you, but what the cartels do is that all various parts of the cartel will bid for a contract, and then when one of them wins the work, they share it out amongst the other members of the cartel.
Well, that's one way of which a cartel works. But don't forget, in France, particularly, many of the iron and steel industries were owned by the government, so the deals that they were doing were government deals, not private sector deals anyway. Now this comes back to fundamental questions about economic theory, about free markets and whether they work or not. Ultimately, they don't.
No,
you've got to have some kind of a plan. Even if you're going to have a market, you have to plan to have one. It doesn't just happen.
Okay, so free markets not working too well for Twitter at the point where Elon Musk was buying it. Lots of the advertisers started pulling out for whatever reason. Maybe these industrialists or whoever they are that were paying for it decided they don't like him anymore. Advertisers can completely, you know, destroy media if they decide that they're going to en masse boycott it for whatever reason. I'm not saying that's what happened exactly with Twitter, but clearly there were some serious problems at Twitter, and when Musk came along hoping, I suppose, to buy it for a song. He's done an interview this week with this guy called James Clayton at the BBC. I'd never heard of him before, Martin, had you?
Nope.
I just found it almost, you know, it's like the best bit of BBC comedy I've seen for decades, watching this Elon Musk run rings around this guy. But anyway, we're going to hear two clips from the Elon Musk interview with the BBC this week. Firstly, from a rather sensible point of view, where there is a proper discussion going on about what's been going on with Twitter. And this is the one the BBC have been putting out. But then there are other clips going around. Here's one which was shared with me earlier this week, which is pretty much a car crash where James Clayton is just falling over himself. And none of the most important questions are asked of Elon Musk, such as, you know, what about accountability when it comes to closing off Donald Trump's account and things like that? Because, of course, the BBC are anti-Trump, so they don't even think to ask questions like that. That's how it works, folks. But anyway, so we're here, a couple of clips. First of all, one that the BBC wanted you to hear, maybe, and then one they didn't.
These are rough numbers. A revenue drop from $4.5 billion to $3 billion. Expenses went from 4.5 to 6, creating a $3 billion negative cash flow situation, and Twitter having $1 billion in the bank. That's 4 months to live. So unless drastic action was taken immediately, this company is going to die and be owned by banks.
Let's talk about that drastic action, because almost immediately you sacked a lot of Twitter workers. And I spoke to them. It was very easy to speak to them when it happened. And the way they said, pretty much everyone said, is that it felt quite haphazard.
It was.
And it felt a little bit uncaring.
I wouldn't say uncaring. The issue is like the company's either going to go bankrupt or if we do not cut costs immediately. This is not a caring, uncaring situation. It's like if the whole ship sinks, then nobody's got a job.
Right.
Yeah.
But a lot of people just lost their jobs like that. They didn't even know they'd lost their jobs, they were just frozen out of their accounts.
What would you do?
Well, you might want to give someone some notice. I mean, you might. It's, by the way, I'm not running Twitter, but,
I know,
but this is the criticism, and this is what staff members say. A little bit of notice, you know.
No, I understand. If you have 4 months to live, 120 days. In 120 days, you're dead. So what do you want to do?
How much are you worth?
I don't know.
But we're talking about around the $200 billion mark. I mean, it's not quite. You're framing it in a way that you know, that it had a few months to live. You're quite a rich man.
I sold a lot of Tesla stock to close this deal. I did not want to sell the Tesla stock.
So that's BBC guy James Clayton chatting with Elon Musk. Martin, what do you make of that conversation?
Well, I mean, Elon Musk made the obvious point that, you know, I bought the company because it was bankrupted. And, of course, that's what, you know, you tend to sack people in that condition.
I mean, it's a good time to buy it, too, if it's less worth.
Well,
less.
I suspect he's going to regret it. I suspect what's going to happen is Elon Musk is not nearly... I mean, the problem with these kind of super-duper businessmen like Trump and Elon Musk and all the others is they claim that they're geniuses, and in actual fact, they may actually be losers.
I mean, as an interviewer, I just thought it was appalling, really, because he's been given a very good reason why you're going to have to sack so many people, which I rather like Elon Musk's answer there. If the ship sinks, then nobody's got a job, you know, and that surely should be the end of the matter. But yet, this chap, James Clayton, still keeps going on and on, but you know, you should give people notice and you should have done this, and actually Musk come back to him and says, well, what would you do? And he says, I'm not going to answer that, but how much are you worth? So he's suggesting that actually Elon Musk should plow some of his own, loads of his own personal money into keeping it going.
As Musk pointed out, he had to sell loads and loads of Tesla shares to buy Twitter, and that's the point I'm making. Maybe, Elon, you shouldn't have bought Twitter. Maybe it's a silly thing to do. What about that?
You know why he's done it?
Because it's a way of, it's an ego thing. It's the power of
controlling.
It's not
just ego, it's media.
Yes.
And he's a Bilderberger. The Bilderbergers understand media. They want to control media. Where in the old days they were very much interested in, they still are interested in banking, that's for sure, in oil. That's now out of fashion, and now media is what these global elite really love.
Yes, I'm sure that that's Elon Musk's calculation, but I think he may have miscalculated. Because things like Twitter can come and go, you know. I mean, Facebook can die. Things like these things come and go, and they're not necessarily. You know, and the brand is possibly useless. And of course, Musk may think he can turn it around because he's such a genius and all the rest of it. But of course, a lot of these people depend on Musk. Trump in his own small way, they are in fact dependent on having the right contacts in the government and the military and so on in order to prosper. And they don't always make, I mean, how many times has Trump been bankrupt? Quite a few times. But of course, in the US, going bankrupt is part of, growing up. You know, if you haven't been bankrupt two or three times, you're not a real businessman. And of course, it's just not necessary. There's a lot of ideology and mystification around these people. They are incredibly wealthy and they're very arrogant, but they're not necessarily geniuses. They're just, they're just who they are and where they are.
Anyway, I think Musk ran rings around him there, and he does so even more in the next clip we've got, which is, I mean, really has to be described as a complete car crash for the BBC. The I mean, this is on principle, you would have hoped that they would have had a decent interviewer, but this guy doesn't really seem to know much what he's talking about. He doesn't really seem to be listening. He's just been given a list of questions he's got to ask and then keep persisting and persisting. He thinks he's going to get a certain answer, but Musk thinks on his feet. He's not going to get that answer. He's going to get a different answer, and he doesn't seem to be able to deal with it at all. But, I mean, the principle, Martin, that the BBC used to be, when I was there, certainly is, that you would put someone to interview the richest man in the world. You would have someone who had a bit of a track record and maybe wasn't in their 20s.
Yeah, somebody like Andrew Neil, for example, would probably probably had something to say to him.
But they got rid of Andrew Neil. What about Dimbleby? He would make a good interview.
Or Paxman, even.
Yeah. So one of these people should have been doing that job. The BBC didn't do that. And I mean, my own opinion, when I saw it, I thought, well, this is ridiculous. What are they playing it? It's almost like they're committing some sort of harakiri deliberately. You know, so there may be people at the BBC who are just thinking, well, let's just make this into a farce by putting a rookie in and letting Elon Musk throwing him to the lions kind of thing.
Well, I look forward to hearing the growling and chomping
and the whimpering. Okay, let's have a listen to that now. This is our second clip with James Clayton from the BBC interviewing Elon Musk, or maybe the other way around.
You know, we have spoken to people who have been sacked that used to be in content moderation, we've spoken to people very recently who were involved in moderation, and they just say there's not enough people to police this stuff, particularly around hate speech. In the company.
What hate speech are you talking about? I mean, you use Twitter.
Right.
Do you see a rise in hate speech?
I mean,
but just a personal anecdote. Like, what do you? I don't.
Personally, my For You, I would see I get more of that kind of content, yeah, personally. But I'm not going to talk to the rest of, for the rest of Twitter. So
you see more hate speech personally?
I would say I would see more hateful content in that.
Content you don't like or hateful? What do you mean? To describe a hateful thing.
Yeah, I mean, you know, just content that will solicit a reaction, something that may include something that is slightly racist or slightly sexist, those kinds of things.
So you think if something is slightly sexist, it should be banned?
Is that what
you're saying?
I'm not saying anything.
I'm just curious. I'm trying to understand what you mean by hateful content, and I'm asking for specific examples. And you just said that if something is slightly sexist, that's hateful content. Does that mean that it should be banned?
Well, you've asked me whether my feed, whether it's got less or more. I'd say it's got slightly more.
That's why I'm asking for examples. Can you name one example?
I honestly don't use.
A single example.
I'll tell you why, because I don't actually use that For You feed anymore because I just don't particularly like it. A lot of people are quite similar. I only look at my
following. You said you've seen more hateful content, but you can't name a single example, not even one.
I'm not sure I've used that feed for the last 3 or 4 weeks, and I.
Well, then, how did you see the hateful content?
Because I've been using Twitter since you've taken it over for the last 6 months.
Okay, so then you must have at some point seen that you For You hateful content. I'm asking for one example.
Right.
And you can't give a single one.
And I'm saying... I say, sir,
that you don't know what you're talking about.
Really?
Yes, because you can't give me a single example of hateful content, not even one tweet. And yet you claimed that the hateful content was high.
Well...
That's a false.
No, what I claimed...
You just lied.
What I claimed was... there are many organizations that say that kind of information is on the rise. Now, whether it has on my feed
one
or
example.
Not, I mean, I, right, and
literally
if you look at someone like the Strategic Dialogue Institute in the UK, they will say that. So
people will say all sorts of nonsense. I'm literally asking for a single example, and you can't name one.
Right, and as I already said, I don't use that feed. But I don't think this is getting anywhere.
You literally said you experienced more hateful content, and then couldn't name a single example.
Right, and as I said,
that's absurd.
I haven't actually looked at that feed.
Then how would you know if it's hateful content?
Because I'm saying that's what I saw a few weeks ago. I can't give you an exact example. Let's move on. We only have a certain amount of time. COVID misinformation. You changed the COVID misinformation.
Has BBC changed this COVID misinformation?
The BBC does not set the rules on Twitter, so I'm asking you.
No, I'm talking about the BBC's misinformation about COVID.
I'm literally asking you about, you changed the labels, the COVID misinformation labels. There used to be a policy, and then disappeared. Why do that?
Well, COVID is no longer an issue. Does the BBC hold itself at all responsible for misinformation regarding masking and side effects of vaccinations and not reporting on that at all? And what about the fact that the BBC was put under pressure by the British government to change its editorial policy? Are you aware of that?
This is not an interview about the BBC.
Oh, so. You thought it wasn't?
I see now why you've done Twitter Spaces. I am not a representative of the BBC's editorial policy. I want to make that clear. Let's talk about something else.
You want to
talk about
the BBC? You too.
All right, let's talk about something else.
You weren't expecting that.
Let's talk about something else.
No, he wasn't expecting. Anyway, I actually was tittering and actually laughing out loud through that clip, Martin. But it's in a bit of a shame, isn't it, when BBC Current Affairs becomes a laughing stock. And I mean, Musk, you've got to admit, whatever your views on COVID, etc., is running rings around the guy.
Well, he hasn't done his homework, has he? If you're going to say there's hateful content, you should be able to find at least one example of it. And, you know, it's not that difficult if you can just trawl around and find something. He was amateurish in the extreme, wasn't he? But, of course, when Musk, with his calm manner, says, and what about BBC misinformation, blah, 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 and, of course, he hasn't actually come up with any examples either, other than his own.
If it was Paxman, he'd be turning the whole thing around on him and saying, come up with some examples then.
Yes, exactly. You know. That's exactly what Paxman would have done. Well, you know, you say there's misinformation. What do you think was BBC misinformation? And say the government were in control. He said, yes, the government are in control of the country.
It's fascinating.
It's a pandemic,
though,
you know.
It's fascinating. I think the way that Musk turned it into an interview of the BBC, and he hinted at that right at the end there, didn't he? You know, that you thought you weren't being interviewed. So anyway, much as mad as Musk is with his little devices that you drill into your skull in order to connect the internet into your brain, I was quite entertained to see that. And also, of course, he's made a whole load of money out of this zero carbon stuff with his Tesla cars and that. So he's kind of piggybacked on that.
What I was saying earlier. These people don't end up making their money without being in the pocket of vested interest in government.
It's not just government, it's also the big banks and policymakers and where their money is heading. So if you're going to a Bilderberg conference with Elon Musk and some of the world's top bankers, he's going to be chit-chatting about, well, whereabouts do you want to spend your money, Mr. Bank, and I'm going to be there.
Well, that's right. And also government regulations, yeah? If you've got government regulations that we've all got to have electric cars by whatever date it is, well, that's a ka-ching, ka-ching moment for the electric car manufacturers.
That's one of the reasons he's made so much money, of course. Anyway, so another story now, and Martin's favourite, which is, do you think King Charles should be our head of state, Martin?
Well, I'm generally against the monarchy, but I recognise that at the moment, that's not the majority view. It's certainly the majority view in Barbados and in places like Australia and elsewhere. There's a big issue about whether the monarchy should be head of state.
With the rather strong possibility that he had his wife murdered, do you think he's the right person for the job?
I'm not going to comment on that because I don't think it was necessarily him that had his wife murdered. His wife was murdered, I accept that, but it wasn't necessarily him that did it. I think that's another delusion that people have.
I didn't say he did it. I think he had her. And he was definitely involved in it. I mean, if you read most of the books around him, particularly around the John Morgan books, How They Murdered Princess Diana, for example, they had a group of a meeting with the private secretary of the Queen and Prince Charles called the Way Ahead Group, which was looking at, my goodness, can we find a way ahead with Diana being divorced and running around on the press, etc., because she's a threat to the monarchy.
Yes, and if that's the case, Tony, he shouldn't be the king. He should be in prison, shouldn't he?
Anyway,
okay, but you've got to prove that in court,
I don't know
you?
If Neil Oliver would go quite so far, but anyway, he had quite a lot to say a couple of days ago after the Sunday Mail on Sunday's article explaining the conflict that there is going on right now in the Anglican Church about whether Charles should have this multi-faith coronation service. But anyway, here's Neil Oliver.
We all know, it's reported years ago, wasn't it, that Charles said that when the time came, he wanted to be defender of all faiths. His duty as the constitutional monarch is to uphold the Church of England, but, you know, he wants to be defender of faiths in plural, which it's the addition of a single letter S, but it matters a great deal because the coronation oath is foundational to his coronation and to his existence as a constitutional monarch. there's no getting away. We're only 4 weeks out from the event, and there's no word yet on what he will say, what oath he will take. But there's just no denying that Charles, he pinned his colours to the mast, so to speak, long ago. You know, he's supposed to be, he's the sovereign, but we are all sovereign. He is the first sovereign, first among equals. But he is supposed to, and we've got every right to expect that in the coronation oath, that he will say that he will defend our rights as free sovereign people, and that he will defend Britain as a sovereign nation, and that he will, you know, give his word that this country and we the people will not be placed under the overlordship of some external power. You know, we are an independent entity, and he, as the sovereign, swears to protect our freedoms and rights as sovereign individuals. But he's compromised. He is compromised because, you know, he launched the Great Reset. He trumpeted the fact that it was on his website, the Great Reset, the same one that's the life mission of Klaus Schwab and the World Economic Forum. Charles had that on his royal website as soon as anybody had it anywhere. And the Great Reset, it, once you start looking into it, would compromise Britain's position as a nation independent of interference and overlordship from elsewhere. In that context, you know, look at all that's out there. You've got the World Health Organization as well, with their pandemic preparedness treaty, by which, if member states sign up to it, would cede control of the next pandemic. Decisions about locking down and about mandated vaccines and all of the rest of it, even the declaration of the existence of a pandemic, would be ceded to the World Health Organization, and we would have to do as we are told. At the launch of COP26, Charles, you know, opened that event in Glasgow, and he talked then about the need for, quote, a military-style campaign to whip us all into shape to save the planet. None of it is the right noise. He's not creating the right mood music for a constitutional monarch who will defend our independence, our freedom, our liberties. So I'm profoundly troubled. I quite openly go so far as to say Charles, as he has been, cannot be the king.
Well, there you go. That's a statement from Neil Oliver. I think you probably would agree with him on the end result, Martin, but probably not on the way. On the same similar. I mean, there's also this group Republic, which has been campaigning for this for years. But the fact of the matter is, Charles is in all sorts of hot water here because he's a very much a hands-on head of state. His mum wasn't. I mean, she was there to get involved when things get rough, and she would step in sometimes, and that was considered controversial in itself. But he seems to be, I mean, he's had a big role, for example, in the Windsor Framework, which is the settlement between the European Union and the British government over Northern Ireland. That's the sort of thing that his mum would have steered well clear of. She'd have just let him get on with it.
No, I don't think she would, actually. I think that Neil Oliver does complain too much. British monarchs have never been constitutional monarchs that just mind their own business and protect our liberties. They are part of an undemocratic system, which the Irish, for example, got rid of in the 1920s. They don't have a monarch. They have a president. The Barbadians have just agreed last year at a referendum. They are no longer a monarchy. They've now got the prime minister as head of state. But whatever, this is perfectly feasible.
You've got whole loads of different people from the sort of republic side like you, and people like Neil Oliver who question whether he should be the Church of England when he's a multi-faith person.
Well,
so he's in for a rough time, isn't he?
He's in for a rough time, but it's not going to be as rough as the poor people who are going to lose their housing in a crash or.
Yeah, but they're not heads of state, are they?
No, all right, but let's put it this way. The British Constitution doesn't exist. There isn't a constitution. It's a series of bodges and compromises that made over the years in which, in actual fact, there's no logical consistency whatsoever. Now, the German constitution is a constitution because it was written at the end of the war after military defeat. So the separation of powers between the different sections.
So does that mean it's just going to be when Charles is made king a kind of free for all?
No, it's going to be the same free for all we've always had.
The reason why
the Queen did what she did is we were talking earlier about the mayoral system. the Queen chose to be a reticent monarch and not to stick her finger in too closely. But previous monarchs in this country have. Queen Victoria was a Tory. She was definitely a Tory. She liked Disraeli because Disraeli made her Empress of India. She didn't like Gladstone because he wanted Ireland to have home rule.
The whole of post-war Britain has been kind of defined by the Queen's attitude.
Yeah.
And now we're seeing quite a big change, aren't we? It's a changing of the guard in a tiny version. The difference between Ferguson and Marvin as our two mayors. A collegiate type of architect mayor, followed by someone who very much sees himself as chief executive. He's in charge.
Well, I'll tell you what the real big change is exactly when Henry VIII became head of the Church of England, he rammed that through. And he made it, and that was a very, very controversial decision at the time and led to civil wars and all sorts of things. Mm. But he didn't stick with the Pope like his father, Henry VII. He wanted to be the head of the Church of England. And that's why Prince Charles is still the head of the Church of England. And of course, that's controversial. The Church of England should be disestablished. It shouldn't be part of the state.
Maybe Charles will do that.
Well, he can't do it because it's not up to him to decide. It's actually up to the Synod of the Church of England. And in actual fact, my parents are active Anglicans and they've always thought that the church shouldn't be part of the state. And in actual fact, we should have a secular state. Yeah, there shouldn't be any religion in the state.
Well, that's certainly a view.
Yeah. It certainly would be. It's a view in the United States of America. And it's a view...
Yeah. How successful it's been there.
Well, it's one of the few things that is successful. Everything else is a load of rubbish.
Now they've got Satanists bringing up the Baphomet Baphomet statue.
That's called freedom of speech on Twitter, Tony. Aren't you in favour of freedom of speech on Twitter?
Little Rock, Arkansas. Is Baphomet popping up, you know?
Yes.
Isn't that wonderful?
Should they go to prison for being Satanists?
Who's saying that? Nobody. I'm not saying that. But it certainly shouldn't be part of the state.
Part of the state. They are allowed.
That's what they're asking for. They're saying we need equal standing with Christianity.
What we're saying is we want the same rights as everybody else under the Constitution.
Do you think Satanists should have equal...
I think people should be allowed to be Satanists if they want.
So they should have equal status with Christianity?
No. They should have equal status as citizens to have free opinions.
You're getting a bit mixed up here. What about in the Capitol building? A statue of Christ next to the statue of Satan?
In the US, it's been very controversial. You're not supposed to have any symbols of any religion in any government building. Same thing in France. Because it's potentially going to cause conflict. The reason why they did that in the United States during the American Revolution was because there was quite a variety of different views about religion.
Well, maybe that conflict is going on anyway outside the building and it's a bit silly to pretend it isn't.
No, you can discuss it in the building, but it does actually create a problem where one religion, the Church of England, is regarded as part of the... In Scotland, it's not the Church of England that runs the state. It's actually the Kirk of Scotland, which isn't. It's a Calvinist church, quite separate from the Church of England. And of course, as we know, in Northern Ireland, there's a big issue about... What religion should be allowed. That's why the state has to be secular.
Anyway, I know, you know, your views on this, but in the same edition of the Mail on Sunday last weekend, on Easter Day, there was another article which was really interesting, I thought. Anyway, it's Did Jesus Visit Cornwall? Now, on the surface of it, sounds silly, but you, as a bit of a historian, and me too, Martin, I mean, you know what they've done, actually, this is about a book that's been published about this myth. It sounds beyond belief, but according to a local folklore, he sailed here as a teenager with his tin merchant uncle. Well, many of us have heard this, but there is actually now a book out which is looking at all of the... This is framed very much in this, and did those feet in ancient time walk upon England's mountain green, you know, which is the William Blake hymn, Jerusalem. But this book is looking at a lot. There's actually quite a lot in the West Country of various folklore and named places which do seem to suggest that Jesus may have landed with Joseph of Arimathea off St. Anthony's Head in South Cornwall. Have gone along to something called Ding Dong Mine because they were ferrying, apparently, tin back to the Middle East, and then gone to Tintagel and sailed up to, believe it or not, Burnham-on-Sea. Did Jesus go to Burnham-on-Sea? And then again by ship to Weston-super-Mare and then to Glastonbury. So what they've done is they've looked at the various names of places around the West Country where Jesus' name is there. There's the things like a Jesus Whirl. Dr. Gordon Strachan is former Church of Scotland minister and Oxford history graduate. He went further, stating that Jesus came here as part of his boyhood education and studied geometry and spiritual matters with in Glastonbury. Lewis told the Mail on Sunday, the legend that Jesus came here actually is very strong. It's a historical fact that Christianity came to Cornwall very early on. Martin?
Well, the mainstream historiographical analysis is that Jesus did not come to Britain. So, and I think it's quite unlikely if you think about it. It's quite a long way, and it's not at all, why would he come? He was a Jewish rabbi.
He wasn't really a youngster,
he was going around preaching to people.
Okay, so there are various places called like the Jesus Well, mm-hmm. this kind of thing.
Christianity is quite an influential thing, isn't it?
St. Anthony's Church. Then there's also the village church in St. Anthony, is set apart from other parish churches by its 1,000-year-old arch above its door, inscribed with hieroglyphics said to commemorate Jesus' birth and visit to Cornwall. High on Penwith Moors, near the tip of Cornwall, is the pumping engine house. Above that serve what's reputedly the oldest tin mine in Britain. The Ding Dong Mine owes its name to the church in nearby Madron, where a bell rang to mark the end of the miners' shift. And so you just think that this is just silly stuff, or is it? Because, I mean, the thing that makes this different, this story, is that what they've done is they've actually taken the time and trouble to go around and find place names that may suggest that they've got some kind of historical link to an ancient journey by Jesus and Joseph.
Well, don't forget, Christianity has been in this country for many thousands of years, and therefore people tend to call things after things that they know about in religion. So there's plenty of churches dedicated to Jesus around here, but it doesn't mean Jesus came here. It just means people say this is the Jesus Church. You know? Well, so what?
Some of these names may have been long after. For example, say in the Dark Ages, someone said this is Jesus Well.
Yes,
it is quite common that certainly before people could read and write, that these things were passed on in the local area when people didn't move around so much, just by word of mouth.
Well, I mean, people believe in, and they still believe it, and the tourists are told this, that Mary Magdalen turned up in Provence, and she's buried there. But, of course, the Middle Ages was a crazy time, Tony.
It was.
People believed all sorts of stuff. Yeah. And, you know, it doesn't make much sense.
Anyway, I just thought this had a little bit more of a flavour to it than, and it's, you know, some historians have done a bit of legwork and found all these little places than just the sort of crazy myth. And I'll put a link up to that map of Jesus' apparent journey as a boy to the west of England, up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, and we'll be back after the break to give our international chit-chat about these international leaks from the United States. Are they real, or are they just an American psyop?
fairness of the law. With my mouth will I ever be showing thy truth from one generation to another.
That's the Staple Singers from 1971. Respect Yourself and Glowworm, I Lift My Cup. The date was 1994. I think I'm going to try and dig out some more of this dance stuff from the early 90s. I love it personally. And also, it's got a kind of Friday night feel to it, hasn't it? Martin, let's start, though, with the leaks. We've seen this, actually, story was bubbling along the tail end of last week. I think it was Thursday evening or Friday. I saw the first inklings of it. And I couldn't actually find any stories which had been leaked from the Pentagon to really drill into. So I just skipped over it last week. But it's been growing more and more legs this week. It's almost as if it's a story that they tried to kind of ignore it and it won't go away. I'm also a little bit suspicious that the Pentagon and the psychological warfare people in the West have taken a few days to decide exactly how they're going to spin it.
I think that's exactly what's happened. I'm not, obviously, it's hard to know exactly what happened here, but I mean, I think the analysis I've been reading suggests that the original documents, which, you know, there were photographs of the original documents, look genuine. Although there seems to have been some fiddling around with the casualty figures.
Maybe the reason that they were photographed was because if you were to share an electronic version, that might be more easy to trace.
That's partly true, and it's also because a photograph of a piece of paper is evidence that there's actually a leak. I think some of the stuff that's been going on, Bellingcat and the New York Times have been saying that there's lots of other things that have been leaked, and we've seen the documents, and they say this and this and this, but they haven't shown the documents. And what's extraordinary to me is that the New York Times found out who this leaker was before the FBI, and they basically put a team on to find out who'd leaked the documents. Now, never mind analysing what's in the documents. They saw it was their duty as the media. Cathy Johnson's got a good article about this today on Consortium News. The establishment media in the US think it's their job to find out who leaked this stuff rather than analyse whether it's what it is and whether there's any good. I mean, they just don't care about that. That's irrelevant.
Yes, so the extent of the intelligence leak exposes US spying on its adversaries and its allies. It's pretty embarrassing. I mean, there is a view, maybe we could deal with this before we get stuck in, there is a view out there that this is maybe a managed leak, a deliberate leak, in order to, I mean, a sort of interfactional fight in the deep state, in the United States particularly, where the deep state is saying to the Biden team in the White House, look, this war is not going well at all, you know, forget the spin. We need to throw much more weight into the fight.
Well, the Pentagon Papers, when they were released in the 70s by...
Daniel Ellsberg.
Daniel Ellsberg. He was opposed to the war, and that's why he leaked them, because he was a senior person and he had access. Now, the story that we're being told now, this relatively junior person managed to get access.
Very junior.
And decided to leak them onto a very obscure gamer's website because he was involved with these gamers and he wanted to impress them about what he knew, blah, blah, blah. Now, I think wherever they came from, the initial documents that we've seen look genuine. And what's shocking about them is there's nothing in there that we didn't know. Basically, the Ukrainians are running out of ammunition. They can't possibly win.
Well, so you say that, Martin, this stuff has not been in the mainstream press,
has
it? We've been talking about it here for months.
No, I know, but I mean, everybody who knows, who's been following what's been going on knows.
I might even say, till we're blue in the face.
Yes.
But, you know, we've known this stuff for a long time. It's nice to see it coming out.
There's nothing that's that surprising in the tranche of documents. The only thing that is surprising is the absurdity of the casualty figures, because the Americans, for their own... in their own internal discussion, if the documents are correct, are basically going along with the idea that the Russians have had higher casualties than the Ukrainians. Now, this is basically just what the figure that they give in these internal documents is the figure that Kiev gives for its casualty figures. So, in other words, with all the resources of the CIA and all of the Hummins and SIGINT intelligence they've got, they just rely upon the Ukrainians to tell them how many casualties they've taken, and they don't bother to make any checks of their own.
It's my understanding that one of these documents that's been leaked says that actually they believe that the Ukrainian casualties are nearly double what they're being told.
Yes, all right, but the point is it's actually what's striking about it is that the level of lying, even in secret documents, is still high. people do not want to challenge the consensus about the casualty figures. But of course, it may well be, as you say, that a faction may be behind this, and this boy is being set up as a patsy. Yeah, that he didn't, you know, how did he get access to that level of information is a big question mark. But I mean, there's nothing in there that we didn't already really know, which is that the Ukrainians are losing, and they've been losing for a long time. They haven't got much of a chance to win. They never did have any chance. It's all been incredibly overdone. The idea that somehow they're going to capture back the territory that they lost in 2014, and what's lost since then. I mean, it's just for the birds, really. Kosovo is never going to be part of Serbia. The Serbians are never going to get it back. NATO will never let them. And the same goes for the breakaway republics in the Ukraine. They're never going to be part of the Ukraine. The Russians will never let it happen. And NATO can't stop it any more than the Russians can make Kosovo part of Serbia. They can't. It's too far away.
Okay, so what about this idea that it's a deliberate leak, maybe by the Americans, to put more pressure on the Biden administration to get more involved?
Well, I think the fact is they can't get more involved. They've already sent everything they've got, and it's not enough. They can't just ramp up artillery production within the next 2 weeks so that they can outcompete with the Russians. The Russians are firing 10 times as many shells as the Ukrainians. The Ukrainians are running out of shells. It's as simple as that. It should have been obvious. You don't really need a leak to know this stuff. You just look at the basic facts and figures.
Oh, well, the website, A Son of the New American Revolution, it's SONAR21.com, is calling it a controlled leak and 21-year-old scapegoat. Until I saw the document labeled CIA Operations Center Intelligence Update, I was inclined to believe the leaked documents were the work of a frustrated whistleblower, but I've changed my mind. This looks like a controlled, directed leak by individuals who manipulated the 21-year-old National Guard troop into taking certain documents and posting them on a public server. The CIA Operations Center Intelligence Update is a document produced by analysts in the Operations Center to be delivered to the regular CIA analyst. When I worked in the Ops Center, he says, I was responsible for monitoring traffic from Latin America and flagging items to the analysts in the Latin American division. I would write up a summary paragraph, just like the one that's in the document. This is an internal CIA document. It was not broadcast to any other intelligence agencies. In my 23 years working with the US military commands around the world, I never saw a copy of this type of report circulating among those with the highest clearances. Never. How did a 21-year-old kid get his hands on it?
Well, that's a very big question, isn't it? I mean, it may be, and it's probably quite hopeful, if there are elements within the US military or CIA who realise what a hopeless cause this is, and they want somehow to get the message out there that, you know, we're on a hiding to nothing here. But it may be, you know, things do just happen. You know, I mean, nothing in the documents is at all surprising. You know, it's not as if there's any big revelations here. It's just confirming what most independent observers have been saying all along. I mean, Larry Johnson used to be CIA. Scott Ritter used to be US Marines. Douglas McGregor used to be US Army. And nothing in these documents has contradicted what they've been saying all along what's going on.
US writer James Bamford used to work for the National Security Agency, the NSA, which is their version of GCHQ, always looking at little bits of information and documents flying around, spying in order to do it, even sending human spies from time to time to get information when they need to. The NSA also are feature very big at Menwith Hill, listening into British phone calls and other ways of, I suppose, through bugs, that sort of thing as well. But anyway, here's James Bamford a couple of days ago on Democracy Now, talking about these leaked Pentagon documents. And one of the most important things, it makes it absolutely clear and confirms, Martin, doesn't it, before we hear from him, I'll just get your comment on this, that we've got a lot of US special forces, and most importantly, there's more British special forces over in Ukraine than all other nations combined.
It doesn't surprise me at all. This is what we've suspected all along. And of course, the Russians know very well what we're doing in the Ukraine. I'm sure that I simply have a copper's hunch, for example, that British special forces were involved in the attack on the Kerch Bridge, the assassination of Zakhachenko as the Prime Minister of Donetsk Republic, British special forces.
And one of the things NBC pointed out was a February 28th document assessing pathways for Israel to provide lethal aid to Ukraine, providing hypothetical situations that might drive Israel from its balancing act between Kyiv and Moscow. Mark Secret, the document also suggests what Israeli weapons could be transferred to Ukraine, like Israel's Javelin equivalent and other missile systems. The analysis says the most plausible scenario is that Jerusalem adopts a Turkish model under U.S. pressure. Like Ankara, it would mean that Israel sells lethal defense systems or provides them through third-party entities while openly advocating for peace and offering to host mediation efforts. James Bamford.
Well, once again, it shows how widespread the NSA's eavesdropping capabilities are in terms of picking up what's going on within the Israeli Knesset and the Israeli president's office and so forth, or prime minister's office. So it shows the wide variety of how much we're eavesdropping. The United States has been pushing Israel to get more heavily involved in the supply of weapons to and technology to Ukraine, but Israel doesn't want to do it because it doesn't want to anger Russia. Russia is sort of turning a blind eye to Israel's attacks in Syria, and they're afraid that if they overtly aid Ukraine to a much greater extent, then Russia will be angry at Israel and not allow Israel basically to send its fighters into Syria anymore. So it's a complicated situation, but the United States is apparently able to eavesdrop on decisions that are made within the Israeli government.
And also this latest news out of these documents that Mossad, Israel's spy agency, the equivalent of the U.S. CIA, was pushing Israelis and fomenting a rebellion against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu for gutting the Israeli judiciary.
Well, it shows that we're also eavesdropping on their equivalent of the CIA, basically, the Mossad. And in my book, Spy Fail, I write extensively about how we eavesdrop on Israel. I mean, there's a huge building in the outskirts of Washington, D.C., in Maryland, where the Hebrew linguists are all gathered, and they eavesdrop on whatever communications goes in and comes out of the Israeli embassy. So the U.S. does a great deal of eavesdropping on Israel, both within Israel and of its diplomatic facilities in the U.S.
And just to refresh our audience's memory, we last had you on, Jim, as we talked about Spy Fail, your new book, and your revelations about Benjamin Netanyahu's interference with the 2016 election. The media made a lot of allegations that Russia was involved with subverting the U.S. elections in 2016. But just lay out once again for us what you learned about Netanyahu's efforts to support Trump in the 2016 election and the extent to which he went, something that is known by the U.S. government and Congress, but not revealed.
Well, everybody remembers Russiagate and the hysteria that the news media, mainstream news media, basically focused on that for 2 years, looking under every rock for a Russian spy or Russian collaborator, and they never found any. There never was any collusion between the Trump administration and the Trump campaign and the Russian government. So the Mueller report came up with a blank when it came to Russian collusion. What people don't know, until I reported in my book, is the fact that the Mueller investigation was not only looking at Russia, they were also looking at other countries that may have been involved in eavesdropping and spying within the U.S. and also being involved with campaigns. And what they found was that there was an Israeli agent who had been sent over by Prime Minister Netanyahu to collude with the Trump campaign. The idea was that the Israeli agent would pass on intelligence that the Israelis came up with to help the, this is intelligence on Hillary Clinton, to help the Trump campaign win. And the quid pro quo for that was that the Trump campaign, or President Trump, once he was elected, would recognize Jerusalem as being the sole, basically, possession of Israel. In other words, it wouldn't be divided between Israel and Palestine, which is always would have been the hope to have a peaceful resolution of that. It would be solely Israeli. So that was the deal. And I discovered this by coming across the actual affidavit, FBI affidavit, and search warrant. The search warrant was for the communications of this Israeli agent, and it laid out in the affidavit, the FBI affidavit, exactly how this plot took place. So it was extraordinary to see that all these 2 years they were doing this investigation on Russia and coming up empty, and they never revealed to the American public the fact that there was this Israeli agent who was deliberately attempting to throw the election for the benefit of Benjamin Netanyahu.
So that's James Bamford, author of The Puzzle Palace, and another book, a more recent book, fascinating guy. I think it's a super source, basically. But Martin, he kind of gets in off the subject of these leaks and into something completely different at the end there, where he's saying, well, you know, Russiagate was a load of nonsense. What was really going on was much more interesting, was actually Israeli interference in US elections.
Well, I presume that's what his book's got. He's plugging the stuff in his book there, isn't he? Because that's nothing to do directly with these leaks that we were talking about earlier. Well, and of course, I mean, everybody knows that the Israelis put an enormous amount of effort into controlling both US and UK politics. I mean, this is what all this Al Jazeera uncovered inside the Labour Party, wasn't it?
Well, again, I will put a link up to that full interview on the wonderful Democracy Now! Fantastic. I think it's George Soros funded, but anyway. I mean, it's mostly pretty pedestrian, but every now and again they have a fantastic interview, and that is an interviewee, rather, which was James Bamford there. So I'll put it up on our show page later at thisweek.org. UK. Lots and lots going on, though, particularly in the background of is these leaks, Martin, and a big embarrassment for the Americans. So I will put a link up to that article, which is talking about the potential of the leaks being deliberate, but so just to make sure we get another point of view. I don't think that's necessarily that credible looking at it at the moment. But yeah, lots and lots, like I say, Martin, lots and lots going on, isn't there? Because we've had the Biden trip to the UK. It's almost as if this leak in the States is timed to embarrass Biden as he's away from home. Who knows if the timing was deliberate or accidental, but that certainly could be the case, couldn't it?
It might be, but I think when you're talking about things like that, you're getting into the nitty gritty of timelines, tradecraft, and so on. And unless you've got to draw some broad conclusions about things without getting too detailed.
But if this guy is behind it, who's been arrested, he's in the Air National Guard, basically. So he's like a sort of like Dad's Army flyboy.
He's young. But he is an officer because he's a pilot, and it seems that he may have got access to this stuff.
Maybe one of his friends has got it.
Well, no, it may be that he may have got the password of one of his commanders, which then allows him to access it. Possibly. And the suggestion is being made that because he's involved in this kind of gamers group, you know, presumably for several years he's been involved in this gamers group, several hundred of them, they're all interested in, you know, the stuff there that teenage boys are interested in, and that's when he put it up there to try and impress his teenage chums.
Yeah, so Biden is saying there may be some expansion of internet surveillance after these leaks. So he's saying, well, maybe we're just going to have to kind of shut the internet down because things like this are leaking out, even though it looks as if this is something that's been printed out and photographed. I don't know how you're going to stop that by closing down the internet.
Well, they want to control the internet. that we don't really need a leak to tell us that.
Another thing, that is what they intend to do. Running through a few bits and bobs in the leaks, they say the US doesn't expect Russia-Ukraine peace talks at all this year.
Well, I think that's pretty obvious because the Western powers, particularly the British and the Americans, are determined that there shouldn't be any.
Yeah,
so and if we're determined that there shouldn't be any, then there won't be any, will there?
No. Germany is okaying Poland's request for sending jets to Ukraine at the moment.
Well, that's not surprising, but of course it's pointless because where are these jets going to fly from? If they fly into the Ukraine, they'll be shot down. If they fly from Poland, the airfields in Poland could end up being attacked.
It seems that the Russians aren't really using all the air power they've got, are they? They're holding a lot back, and it may be that if these jets start being used, suddenly the Russian Air Force will massively expand right across the country.
Well, what they've been doing very carefully up to now, as far as I can see, is they've been very careful not to lose their aircraft and helicopters because the Ukrainian air defence has still been fairly robust using Soviet-era kit, Buk missiles and SS-300s. But they're running out of ammo. And the Russian's Air Force now is able to use glide bombs from inside their own territory, which are able to accurately hit Ukrainian positions.
I mean, what's going on? Are the West deliberately withholding ammunition?
No, they're not deliberately withholding it. They've gone to war with the Russians, but they haven't war-gamed it out. You know, I mean, and you don't need to be Napoleon to realise that you shouldn't invade Russia. What's it Montgomery said? There are two rules
in
warfare.
They haven't invaded Russia.
Or they have.
No, they haven't.
Yes, they have.
Because these
places are now part of Russia, and the West is trying to recapture them.
Russia has annexed these places.
Yes, but they're part of Russia. That's what the Russians would say.
But they're not invading the Donbass. It's the other way around. The Donbass is invading Ukraine.
No, that's not. Yes. That's not what the Russians think. Okay?
Well, yes, it is. Actually,
this is what the war's all about, Tony. This is exactly what the war's all about.
Who is doing the invading here? The Russians are. The Russians are taking territory.
No,
they are.
No, the territory. The Americans invaded the Ukraine by overthrowing the government in 2014.
They may be justified in doing it, but you can't say that the Russians are not.
We're talking about the meaning of words here, aren't we?
No, we're not. We're saying,
yes, we are.
Ukraine is a country. Certain parts of it have decided they don't want to be with Ukraine anymore. Very few, if any, of those are now in any way in Ukraine's hands. They're now in Russian hands because the Russians have pushed their soldiers and their forces into eastern Ukraine and taken a whole vast thousands and thousands of square miles of eastern Ukraine. So that's not an invasion by the Ukrainians, is it?
Yes, it is, because they don't control that territory. The people there don't want to be part of the Ukraine. This is what this is about. They don't, just like the Irish don't want to be part of the United Kingdom, the majority of them in the north and the south. That's a reality, Tony. So if Britain sends its army into the north of Ireland, they're invading Ireland, aren't they? You're
justifying civil wars all over the world.
Civil wars are fought on exactly these principles, aren't they?
So you are justifying.
I'm just saying that people that
don't fight a civil war are pussies, aren't they?
People that go to war have different views about who the aggressors are, don't they? That's exactly what it's about.
Zelensky's been calling this week for the Black Sea to become the Sea of NATO.
Well, he can say that, but of course it isn't the Sea of NATO, is it? And it's not the Baltic Sea either, no. As Rishi Sunak and Liz Truss need to remember.
Yeah, you said something about Biden and his trip. So, I mean, there's not much to say about this, really, because he's just come over, he stayed in Northern Ireland a little bit, he made some very dull speech, but he made a massive gaffe, didn't he?
Well, it's not a massive gaffe.
Well,
it's just rather typical.
Really.
When he was in Dundalk, he was making a speech to the Irish dignitaries or whatever, and he managed to mix up the All Blacks, the New Zealand rugby team, and the Black and Tans, the British paramilitaries who fought in the 20s. And of course, you could say, look, he's an old guy, and they've both got black in the name, yeah.
Was the context? Was he actually talking about the Black and Tans or the All Blacks?
No, he was trying to talk about the All Blacks because he's trying to show that he's wearing a tie, an Irish rugby tie, which was given to him by one of his relatives who played in the match in which the All Blacks were defeated. It was actually played in Chicago, and of course the All Blacks never used to be defeated at all. It was likely they do get defeated these days, but at one stage to defeat the All Blacks was like, wow, you've done it. But he referred to them as the Black and Tans. Which, of course, he's got Ireland in his mind, he's in Ireland, it's black. Come on, it's only 25,000 miles difference.
US President Joe Biden made an awkward gaffe. This will be up on our show page, don't worry. During a speech on his visit to Ireland on Wednesday, he accidentally confused the name of the New Zealand rugby team with a contentious War of Independence era police force. Biden was speaking at the Windsor Bar in Dundalk, County Louth, when he referred to the shamrock tie that he was wearing. So, I mean, you know, this is just an appalling. It shows he doesn't really know what he's talking about. So, hence, we haven't got any clips from Biden. But, yeah, I mean,
he's famous for making these gaffes, isn't he? Let's face it. Yeah, it's not the first one he's made.
As are many of our leaders, like, as you pointed out right at the start there, Sunak and Truss. More importantly, though, it's been kind of lost in this Pentagon leak story. But Cy Hirsch is saying that the CIA knows quite clearly that Zelensky is skimming all the US aid. So not only money, but also arms are being taken by Zelensky and sold at the black market and money laundered.
Well, I mean, can't be not surprised at all. If people didn't know that was going on, I have a bridge to sell.
This is just Cy Hirsch standing these things up. These rumours have been around for a long time. He's saying, look, here's the evidence.
Yeah, I think what's interesting about this leak and the story about the yacht with the mysterious Ukrainians on that blew up the Nord Stream pipeline is, because Cy Hirsch has got all this inside information about what's going on, they're now trying to create as many false trails as possible so that mainstream media can just say, well, there are various theories floating around about what happened here. There's this one and this one and this one. Gosh, who can tell who's right here? But of course, Cy Hirsch is probably right, as I'm quite sure the Russians and the Chinese know very well.
A wonderful bit of news to finish off with. The United States is just kicking off its annual nuclear war games. The Pentagon is set to begin a round of drills simulating a nuclear war, according to the defense. But you have to watch out for these drills, don't you? Sometimes they just switch a switch and they go real. According to Defense Department press release, the war games come as the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists warns civilization ending war is closer than any time in history, including the Cuban Missile Crisis. Military exercises dubbed Global Thunder 23, being conducted by Strategic Command. American soldiers and bombers will be joined by allies in the war games. The Stratcom press release said this year's drills will include an increase in bomber aircraft flights throughout the exercise. It's typically conducted at the end of the year. Last year, the Pentagon delayed Global Thunder until early 2023. So we're having two Global Thunders this year, aren't we lucky? The first since Russia invaded Ukraine. That was the one earlier this year. During Global Thunder 22, held in November 21, I'm getting confused myself here. US strategic bombers flew within 12.4 miles of the Russian border and simulated a nuclear attack on them.
Well, I mean, that's very sensible of them, isn't it? Let's do that. It's just crazy. And, of course, all the arms control treaties have been ripped up. We don't have any of them anymore. We were quite happy to sign them with the evil communist dictatorship, but democratic Russia, we're not signing any treaties with them because they're evil, aren't they? They don't agree with us, and they want to do things we don't want them to do, and, you know, they're trying to take over the world and all the rest of it.
Okay, so we're going to look now a little bit at hypnosis. We did have a clip from Lauren Guillenot's Israel and the Assassination of the Kennedy Brothers film last week. But I don't know if you noticed, we had also a clip from James Files. We're going to have another clip from the Kennedy assassination film. But also I thought I'd replay a little bit of a clip we played last week from the JFK assassin, James Files, as he's talking about a chap who was involved in the CIA and the anti-Cuba movement in the early 1960s, a guy called David Ferry.
I did not know David Ferry was involved in anything in cancer research. No, I did not.
Okay, so you got any thoughts about Jack Ruby's cancer? Do you think that was natural or unnatural?
I'm going to say it was injected. There's one thing I want to say. When you talk about David Ferry, for his cancer research, I have no knowledge of that at all. But I do know he liked to play around with hypnosis. I think he used it on a lot of young kids, because he was in charge of the Civil Air Patrol.
So, hypnosis, before we hear the clip from the Lauren Guillenot film about hypnosis too, Martin, this is a potentially, what do we know about Sirhan Sirhan, the RFK assassin, or supposed, he's still in jail and still alive. I mean, there seems to be this obsession with using hypnosis in assassinations, not necessarily to hypnotize somebody to kill somebody, which is apparently a very difficult thing to do, but to hypnotize them to be in the right place at the right time with a gun. Someone else does the killing, slopes off, and then they're the fall guy.
Yeah, well, if you look at the MK Ultra, they've been very interested in mind control all along. And, of course, you've got all sorts of stuff on the internet about, oh, gosh, the CIA have got mind control tactics, blah, blah, blah. And everybody, you know, perhaps we're all being brainwashed even as we speak and so on. But, of course, intelligence agencies and things and organisations of this kind are interested in mind control. Of course they are. And they experiment with it. They use drugs. They use any technique that might work. I mean, what was it Annie Mashon used to say about MI5? You want to make people do things. It's money, ideology, coercion, ego. And, of course...
Mice,
yeah. And coercion would involve hypnosis, wouldn't it?
So this could listen involve to, hypnosis. Israel, this clip from Israel and the assassination of the Kennedy brothers, 2020 film by the French filmmaker and investigative journalist Laurent Guillenot.
You have to have the person locked up physically to have control over them. You have to use a certain amount of physical torture involved, and there is also the use of long-term hypnotic suggestion, probably drugs, whatever, and so on. Under these situations where you have all this going for you, like the prison camp and so on, yes, you can brainwash a person to do just about anything. What I'm speaking about are the innumerable instances that we ran into when I was running the country's brainwashing and anti-brainwashing programs.
We know that in the 1960s, American military agencies were experimenting on mental control. Dr. Sidney Gottlieb, son of Hungarian Jews, directed the infamous CIA MK Ultra project, which, among other things, was trying to answer questions like, can a person under hypnosis be forced to commit murder? According to a declassified document dated May 1951, we also know that Ciaran was attending meetings of occultist circles, practicing mental experiments, and this may have created opportunities to submit him to hypnotic programming. Israeli journalist Ronan Bergman has recently revealed that in May 1968, the month preceding Robert Kennedy's assassination, the Amman, the Israeli military intelligence, was planning to assassinate Yasser Arafat by hypnotically programming a Palestinian. The idea was proposed by a Navy psychologist named Binyamin Shalit, who claimed that, quote, if he was given a Palestinian prisoner, one of the thousands in Israeli jails, with the right characteristics, he could brainwash and hypnotize him into becoming a programmed killer.
Well, the clever thing about Sirhan Sirhan is he was pro-Palestinian, and yet the thrust of Laurent Guillenot's film is actually it was the Israelis who were upset about JFK's policies, and they wanted them changed.
RFK's policies.
Sorry, yeah.
Well, yes, I mean, Sirhan Sirhan...
I mean, sorry to interrupt, but one of the things RFK had done is he just launched a national glossy magazine, all about, you know, a political magazine kind of thing, so that he was starting to put his ideas out through there just before he was assassinated.
That's right. So there were various people who wanted him dead, including the Israelis. And I'm perfectly willing to accept that they had a role in it, but I don't think they were the only people.
I mean, I find all this kind of spycraft stuff quite fascinating, because bit by bit you can put together, you know, what is the motives of these people trying to operate behind the scenes. One of the key people, and I came across this interview I did a long time ago now, it's not 2013, 10 years ago, in fact, with Jill Bennett, who's the former head librarian at the Foreign Office, and she did a book about Desmond Morton. Do you want to say a little bit about him, Martin, what you know about Morton? Because he was Winston Churchill's private secretary and a very shadowy figure. She's about to explain why she decided to write a book about him, but what do you know of him?
Well, I think he's the model for C in the James Bond books, because, of course, Fleming used to work for Morton. There's the Secret Service, and then there's the Secret Service within the Secret Service, isn't there? You know, once things are secret, then things can get even more secret, and that you don't know really who's really in charge.
Well, there's an amazing scene, I think, in the In the Op JB book by Christopher Crichton, aka Christopher Crichton, it's actually John Ainsworth Davis that wrote it, where he is called in to see Morton, and in his office, and he hears this sort of noise behind him, and someone had been sort of stood behind the door, and it's the King in the room, just kind of observing what's going on. And of course, their operation, M section of MI6, was purely financed by the King. There was no Foreign Office money went into it. It was a separate section of the Foreign Office that the King personally financed.
Now, I seem to remember we had a discussion in the first part about how the monarchy was a constitutional monarchy, and it's all there to protect our freedoms,
Tony.
Oh,
yes, maybe.
Except it isn't, is it?
Certainly isn't, no, and certainly not with King George VI in that role. And the book is well worth reading. If you've still not read it, shame on you. Op JB by Christopher Crichton. But here's Jill Bennett talking about her book, which is Winston Churchill's Man of Mystery, about Desmond Morton.
He kept coming up in different contexts. In the late 90s, I was involved in a big investigation commissioned by the then Foreign Secretary, Robin Cook, of the Zinoviev letter, which was a letter that had supposed to have been sent by the Comintern to the British Communist Party in 1924. And Morton's footprints were all over that story. Later on, I was working on those issues that used to be called Nazi gold, about the gold that was confiscated from governments and individuals during the Second World War, and I found that he was the British commissioner on the Tripartite Gold Commission, and he turned up in various other places, and I thought there must be something about him, and I got interested in him.
I think you're absolutely right. There was, because between the wars, yes. Desmond met Winston Churchill. How did he meet him?
He actually met Churchill on the Western Front in the First World War, when Churchill briefly served out there in 1916. And the two of them met on the battlefield at a place called Ploegsteert. And they became friends. And they remained friends and saw one another occasionally. In the 20s, Morton bought a house in Kent near Chartwell, where Churchill's house was. And because they were both interested in armament, British rearmament, and British economic preparations for war, they spent a lot of time together. Consequently, later on, when Churchill became Prime Minister in May 1940, he asked Morton to become his intelligence advisor, and Morton went to work with him in Number 10.
Well, that's interesting that they lived close to each other near Chartwell in Kent. I mean, it makes you wonder whether there were clandestine meetings down there, that maybe Churchill walked the mile or so, mile and a half over to see Morton, and the other way round.
I think it's more likely to be the other way round. Churchill was not a great one for walking. We know that Morton used to walk over the hill. In fact, I've travelled that route when I was doing the book to see it's not very far. There are a lot of stories about how Morton supplied secret information to Churchill, but I really don't think that this is true. Government ministers themselves supplied Churchill with information even when he was not in the government. Churchill, after all, had been a cabinet minister on a number of occasions. He was very well plugged in to the political establishment. In fact, Churchill himself had a very wide set of intelligence connections where he collected intelligence, and quite a lot of it he passed on to Morton. So I'm afraid that the nice story about Morton passing him secret information around the back door is not a true one. But on the other hand, both of them had access to secret reports on, for example, German rearmament.
So that's Jill Bennett, the author of Winston Churchill, Man of Mystery. I'll put the full interview with her from 10 years ago up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. It's one of those interviews that YouTube binned when they got rid of my public inquiry channel. So I've put that back up again. A couple of things, though, Martin. You know, you go down to Chartwell in Kent, which was Churchill's home during the war, and they've got a bookshop in there, but apparently even still, Jill Bennett's book is not in the bookshop because it's all a little bit clandestine. I remember going in there and as part of the tour and asking, I said, well, was Winston Churchill a Freemason? and asked the guide while we were in Churchill's study in Chartwell. And he said, oh, no, there's rumours. And I just got up on my phone. I got a picture of an article where his Masonic memorabilia was being auctioned at Christie's. And I said, well, he was, wasn't he? Look, and everyone, there was a sort of titter went around the room, you know. And I wonder whether maybe even in World War One, that's what the connection, which they became friends in World War One, Morton and Churchill, through their Masonic leadership. There's also a lovely story in OpJB, which, I mean, you and I both know that it's a very much a standard, stood-up book. He's got Winston Churchill's letter endorsing his story. He's also got John Ainsworth Davis, Christopher Crichton has also got, I think, is it Mountbatten, a letter from him endorsing his story in the book, because he realised that a lot of people would poo-poo it and not believe it, and in fact he went to a hell of a job to actually even get it published in the first place back in 1996. And another story in there was by Chartwell. There's some woods, if you go on the opposite side of the road to Chartwell, you'll find a little wood, and apparently there was a gypsy that used to live in the wood, and she was the receptacle receptacle that used to pass various secrets to the gypsy, because the gypsy would then pass them on to somebody else, and they were told, oh, just go up to see the gypsy and drop off X for the gypsy, and so the gypsies were used as a sort of secret intelligence conduit by goodness knows who, next to Winston Churchill's residence during the Second World War. So, what do you make of all of this, Martin? What's your any thoughts from you about the way that these things really work behind the scenes? It seems to be completely, you know, only just coming out now, whatever, 80 years after the fact.
Well, there's an awful lot of detail involved in analysing any of this stuff like this. This is why intelligence officers and police officers are full-time employees. Investigative journalists like us have got, you know, Cy Hirsch doesn't get paid to do what he does. He's put it all on Substack. He's getting money from it that way.
The Zinoviev letter, I mean, he's talking about that there, and Morton's involvement. That was massively important in actually shutting Labour out of power, wasn't it?
Yes.
And just say something about it?
Well, the Zinoviev letter seemed to show that the Soviets were controlling Labour Party policy. And it was basically a confection by the British security services to keep Labour out of power. That's absolutely what it was.
Yeah, and it's all only come out now. Anyway, thanks very much to Joe Banks and to Martin Summers. We're going to finish now with a clip from the wonderful, I think, anyway, Altian Charles documentary about Freemasonry. Since we're talking about Morton and Churchill, a hiding place for the conspirators.
Listen to the founder of the Satanic Church, Anton LaVey, tell us in his book, The Satanic Rituals, which is a companion to the Satanic Bible, Masonic orders have contained the most influential men in many governments, and virtually every occult order has many Masonic roots. This is back in 1972, he said this. Now, 40 years later, it should read all governments. Not many. And why is the founder of the Church of Satan talking about Freemasonry, the most respectable and charitable fraternity in the world, that no one seems to talk about and that we never hear about in school? This is why. Because the Satanic Ritual is a blend of Gnostic, Kabbalistic, Hermetic, and Masonic elements. That's crazy, because Freemasonry is a blend of Gnostic, Kabbalistic, and Hermetic elements too. Any Masonic writer will confirm that. But how can that be? Because Freemasonry is Satanism in disguise. On page 106, every rite of the Black Order employed Masonic principles. Every rite of these Black Orders, one of which was called Freunden von Lucifer, which translates to Friends of Lucifer. And guess what? There are numerous manifestations of Satanism in Masonic ritual, including the goat, the coffin, and the death's head. Please awaken, O sleeper, and let the glorious light of the truth dawn upon your sleepy eyes. How did Freemasonry get away with this? Just like Jesus, the greatest enemy of theirs, said they would, by dressing the wolves as sheep. A satanic underground carefully cloaked in Christian trappings. That's how Freemasonry got away with it. We can't find out about it because they run the media and the education system clearly. John F. Kennedy was brutally assassinated after he attempted to inform us that we are opposed around the world by a monolithic conspiracy. Did he know that Lucifer was the god of Freemasonry? I don't know. The Grand Master of my lodge, who was the mayor of the city, was a 32nd degree Freemason. That's one short of the top, one short of the true beginning of a secret religion, and he had no idea what Freemasonry really was. After 42 years in the lodge, they never invited him into the 33rd degree initiation because he couldn't see past the Christian trappings, as they were designed to do exactly that, trap the Christian or trap anyone else who was too sensitive to behold the truth. Thus, Freemasonry could halt their progress at any time without suspicion, because it's a rare thing to reach the 33rd degree, and every Freemason knows that. So that there are no rude awakenings that take place with those that aren't ready to embrace Lucifer as the true god of Freemasonry and the world. This is an ingenious system, birthed by what must have been demonic inspiration. Anton LaVey says that this ingenious system I speak of serves as a rudimentary screening process for organized Satanism. Exactly right. It's a filtering process, as I've said earlier, an international filtering process from which men and women are picked and permitted to enter the world stage. And I'm saying all this for those who naively think that politics and magic ritual do not mix. That's the founder of the Satanic Church. He admits that. Admissions that were never heeded, because no one cares. How else did the Freemasons pull the wool over our eyes? The companion to the Satanic Bible tells us that as well. By filling the world with fools. And who's the biggest fool in the eyes of Freemasonry? An atheist. From the Encyclopedia of Freemasonry. One who does not believe in the existence of God. Such a state of mind can only arise from the ignorance of stupidity. All this time, you're laughing at Christians, and the Freemasons are laughing at you.
So that's Altian Childs. His discussion, Freemasonry, the hiding place for the satanic conspiracy. Well, how interesting. And I think he's done a pretty good job there in putting together lots of the signs given by these celebrities. And it seems to me that these people want to control the media, and they also want to control celebrities. And if a celebrity starts to go off message, and they might well just bump them off, as they did with so many in like the 1960s and the 70s. So time to sign off now. Thanks very much to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, and local freelance journalist Joe Banks, digging out all the dirt on our mayor. And also to sound engineer Dave Bazanko. Download our MP3s and listen in the car or anywhere you like. Do please send me interviews and story tips via Not the BCFM Politics Show page, where you'll also find the podcast, full-length interviews, story links, comment page, and our email addresses. There's also, I have a Tony Gosling Censored Telegram channel. You're more than welcome to join. But don't expect me to put up with sort of chit-chat, and it's just basically information sharing. If you've got something interesting worth having, share it. If I don't like it, I'll delete it. So there you go. It's a little bit... I'm just the editor there. That's the way it works. Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram. You can subscribe to my weekly email list too, and even donate at thisweekoneword.org.uk. But don't be too surprised if you're on Gmail and you don't get a reply, even though I've been working with my internet service provider on that one, trying to get the... But if you're on Gmail, well, shame on you anyway. I'm shadow banned on Twitter at Tony Gosling. We've been streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokescroft in Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream, at radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey, and live on the glorious Not the BCFM Politics Show app. If you can restream us live or rebroadcast this show, just let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show live stream at talkradio.org.uk at 5 o'clock next Friday. God bless. And don't let the ultimately satanic banksters get you down.
was a dark day in Dallas, November 63, a day that would live on in infamy. President Kennedy was a riding high, good day to be living and a good day to die. Being led to the slaughter like a sacrificial lamb. He said, wait a minute, boys, you know who I am. Of course we do, we know who you are. Then they blew off his head while he was still in the car. Shot down like a dog in broad daylight. Was a matter of timing, and the timing was right. You got unpaid debts, we've come to collect. We're gonna kill you with hatred without any respect. We'll mock you and shock you, and we'll grin in your face. We've already got someone here to take your place. The day they blew out the brains of the king, thousands were watching, no one saw a thing. It happened so quickly, so quick by surprise, right there in front of everyone's eyes. Greatest magic trick ever under the sun. Perfectly executed, skillfully done. Wolfman, oh Wolfman, oh Wolfman, how? Rub-a-dub-dub, it's a murder most foul. Hush, little children, you'll understand. The Beatles are coming, they're gonna hold your hand. Slide down the banister, go get your coat. Ferry across the Mersey and go for the throat. There's three bums coming all dressed in rags. Pick up the pieces and lower the flags. I'm going to Woodstock, it's the Aquarian age. Then I'll go over to Altamont and sit near the stage. Put your head out the window, let the good times roll. There's a party going on behind the glassy knoll. Stack up the bricks, pour the cement. Don't say Dallas don't love you, Mr. President. Put your foot in the tank and step on the gas. Try to make it to the Triple Underpass. Blackface singer, whiteface clown. Better not show your faces after the sun goes down. I'm in the red light district like a cop on the beat. Living in a nightmare on Elm Street. When you're down on New Bellum, put your money in your shoe. Don't ask what your country can do for you. Cash on the ballot, money to burn. Dealey Plaza, make a left-hand turn. Going down to the crossroads, gonna flying a ride. The place where faith, hope, and charity died. Shoot him while he runs, boy. Shoot him while you can. See if you can shoot the invisible man. Goodbye, Charlie. Goodbye, Uncle Sam. Frankly, Miss Scarlet, I don't give a damn. What is the truth? Where did it go? Ask Oswald and Ruby Leonard, I know. Shut your mouth, say it, when I slow down. Business is business, and it's a murder most foul. Thank you. Tommy, can you hear me? I'm the Acid Queen. I'm riding in a long black Lincoln limousine, riding in the back seat next to my wife, heading straight on into the afterlife. I'm leaning to the left, got my head in the lap. Oh Lord, I've been led into some kind of a trap. Well, we ask no quarter, no quarter do we give. We're right down the street from the street where you live. They mutilated his body and they took out his brain. What more could they do? They piled on the pain. But his soul was not there where it was supposed to be at. For the last 50 years, they've been searching for that. Freedom, oh freedom, freedom over me. I hate to tell you, mister, but only dead men are free. Send me some love, tell me no lie. Throw the gun in the gutter and walk on by. Wake up, little Susie, let's go for a drive. Cross the Trinity River, let's keep hope alive. Turn the radio on, don't touch the dials. Parkland Hospital, only 6 more miles. You got me dizzy, Miss Lizzie, you fill me with lead. That magic bullet of yours has gone to my head. I'm just a patsy like Patsy Cline. Never shot anyone from in front or behind. Got blood in my eye, got blood in my ear. I'm never gonna make it to the new frontier. Stupidest film I've seen like before. Seen it 33 times, maybe more. It's vile and deceitful, it's cruel and it's mean. Ugliest thing that you ever have seen. They killed him once and they killed him twice. Killed him like a human sacrifice. The day that they killed him, someone said to me, son, the age of the Antichrist has just only begun. Air Force One coming in through the gate. Johnson sworn in at 2:38. Let me know when you decide to throw in the towel. It is what it is, and it's murder most foul. What's new, pussycat? What do I say? I said the soul of a nation been torn away. And it's beginning to go into a slow decay. And that it's 36 hours past Judgment Day. Wolfman Jack, he's speaking in tongues. He's going on and on at the top of his lungs. Play me a song, Mr. Wolfman Jack. Play it for me in my long Cadillac. Play me that only the good die young. Take me to the place Tom Dooley was hung. They say James Infirmary in the court of King James. If you want to remember, you better write down the names. Play it at James 2. Play it, rather go blind. Play it for the man with a telepathic mind. Play John Lee Hooker, play Scratch My Back. Play it for that strip club owner named Jack. Guitar Slim going down slow. Play it for me and for Marilyn Monroe. Play Please Don't Let Me Be Misunderstood. Play it for the first lady, she ain't feeling too good. Play Don Henley, play Glenn Frey. Take it to the limit and let it go by. Play it for Kyle Wilson too. Looking far, far away down Gower Avenue. Play Tragedy, play Twilight Time. Take me back to Tulsa to the scene of the crime. Play another one and another one bites the dust. Play the old rugged cross and in God we trust. Ride the pink horse down that long lonesome road. Stand there and wait for us to explode. Play Mystery Train for Mr. Mystery. The man who fell down dead like a rootless tree. Play it for the reverend, play it for the pastor. Play it for the dog that got no master. Play Oscar Peterson, play Stan Getz. Play Blue Sky, play Dickie Betts. Play Art Pepper, Thelonious Monk, Charlie Parker, and all of that junk. All that junk and all of that jazz. Play something for the Birdman of Alcatraz. Play Buster Keaton. Play Harold Lloyd. Play Bugsy Siegel. Play Birdie Boy Floyd. Play the numbers. Play the odds. Play Cry Me a River for the Lord of the Gods. Play number 9, play number 6. Play it for Nancy and Stevie Nicks. Play Nat King Cole, play Nature Boy. Play Down in the Boondocks for Terry Marlowe. Play It Happened One Night, that white night of sin. There's 12 million souls that are listening in. Play Merchant of Venice, play Merchants of Death. Play Stella by Starlight for Lady Macbeth. Don't worry, Mr. President. Help's on the way. Your brothers are coming. There'll be hell to pay. Brothers, what brothers? What's this about hell? Tell them we're waiting, keep coming. We'll get them as well. Love Field is where his plane touched down, but it never did get back up off of the ground. Was a hard act to follow, second to none. They killed him on the altar of the rising sun. Play Misty for me and that old devil moon. Play Anything Goes and Memphis in June. Play Lonely at the Top and and lonely are the brave. Play it for Houdini, spinning around his grave. Play Jelly Roll Morton, play Lucille. Play Deep in a Dream and play Driving Wheel. Play Moonlight Sonata in F sharp. And the key to the highway for the king of the heart. Play Marching to Georgia in Dumbarton's drums. Play Darkness and Death Will Come When It Comes. Play Love Me or Leave Me by the Great Bird Powell. Play the Bloodstained Banner, play